Hello.
If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com, go to the social issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
The paranormal,
ghosts,
spirits,
demons,
reincarnation,
past lives,
the afterlife,
divination,
exorcisms,
witchcraft,
the unseen.
He's psychic medium Chris George.
And he's Victor the Voice Furman.
We are Second Sight Radio. Join us live
every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time
on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to the October 18th, 2014 broadcast of Global Newsmaker Focus. This program is broadcast on United Public Radio and UPRN, 107.7 FM New Orleans, Louisiana, and 107.9 FM and 105.3 FM Henderson, Pass Christian, Mississippi. Vernell and I are honored to interview author Carl Russo on his book, The Sicilian Mafia, A True Crime Travel Guide. This is Patrice Sheridan speaking. Our author's website, that of Carl Russo, can be found at www.mafiaexposed.com. An excellent blog is found at that site, and the author's book is very engaging and informative. Both blog and book indicate extensive research. And now, directly citing from the author's website, Vernell will note the author's bio details.
Welcome, Carl. We're anxious and very pleased that you were able to join us today. And I'd like to just give some notable remarks about some of your accomplishments. Carl Russo is a San Francisco Bay Area native who has written for the Oakland Tribune, In the Wire, and other publications. Carl fell in love with Sicily on his first trip to the island in 1999 and has returned many times since. In 2010, he began a blog, Mafia Exposed, which became the basis for his book. Carl was also a radio producer and disc jockey at radio station KUSF-FM, San Francisco, from 1990 to 2003. He's a self-described cinema freak, made a comic short in 2005 called Birdie Pepper, which screened at 48 film festivals in 13 countries. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Great. Patrice, did you want to go ahead and get right to it, or...
Well, yes, you know, I'll tell you, and then if you could take the next question, We are just so impressed by your work, Carl. You really make these details come alive in your book regarding the complicated history of Sicily. What a beautiful island, but it's fascinating. First, Carl, what motivated you to make a mafia travel guide? You mentioned falling in love with Sicily. Could you mention some of its many charms?
Well, certainly, yes. Just as a vacation destination, it's fantastic. It's in the middle of the Mediterranean, so you have those gorgeous beaches. And because throughout the centuries, it's always had all kinds of conquerors, for better and mostly for worse, you have all these remnants of these past civilizations. So you have Greek temples that are in better shape than anything you're going to find in Greece. You've got the ancient Arabic layouts on all of the hilltop villages, so there's like a maze, a complete labyrinth that you can go exploring, that going back 1,000 years. You have French influences from the Norman conquest. You've got the beautiful Baroque churches. You've got, of course, some of the late Renaissance frescoes inside, and it's just endless, the fascinations, the discoveries that you can make. And, of course, you also have the food and the vino. It's a great place to visit. When I started going in 1999, I really didn't have any clue that the Sicilian Mafia was still a thing. You know, I thought it was still something that was from the past, or something that Hollywood had kind of turned into its own creation, which turns out it did. But, in fact, the Mafia 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 150 years ago, and today it was still quite a problem. Now, it's not the international threat that it was back then. Even 20 years ago, it was controlling some of the international arms and international drug trade. Now some of the bigger mafias or more powerful mafias on mainland Italy have taken on that mantle. As I learned more about it, I realized that at least Americans have no idea what the Sicilian Mafia is like. And so I set out to actually explore it through its locations. So with my camera and a rental car, I went across the island and tried to photograph various Mafia landmarks. And they're kind of dark. They're murder sites, where the Godfathers lived, where some of their victims are buried. And I put it together. It took about 7 years to make this book. Found a publisher a few years ago, and it came out in February. So, yes, the title is The Sicilian Mafia, A True Crime Travel Guide, with a couple hundred photographs of these grisly and some very beautiful places, too.
Well, you know, for those of us who may never visit Sicily, the photo coverage also is appreciated, and the book is so well written. The details are fascinating. And I really appreciate, too, that concept of each chapter of your book reflecting a day motor trip for the traveler.
Well, thank you for your kind words. Yes, it took me so long to find some of these places, so I have made it easier for you. And I have heard from tourists and travelers that are, you know, a little bit different from your normal pleasure seekers, contacting me, emailing me with book in hand, saying that they've gone to some of these places and actually found what I have listed in there. But yeah, I wanted to lay it out for the tourist who, you know, actually can try and find these places. And a lot of them are a little difficult to find, so that's why I put so many photographs in there. But I think the majority of my book sales so far are people like you who have no plans immediately anyway to go to Sicily. So it's sort of an armchair voyage, too.
Indeed it is. And if I could jump down to a really related question, and that being, is it safe for travelers? Now, I don't know for now if you want to, it's down, we've noted it as six. Is it safe for travelers? You do indicate, Carl, from your book that the traveler should be respectful of Sicilian traditions as well as Sicilian history, including that involved in the mafia and anti-mafia resistance. You advise using discretion and respect with the Sicilian residents.
Well, certainly, because every village has its own mafia boss. And every big city neighborhood has its controlling crime family. Now, I think that's probably the number one first question that I get is it safe for travelers? Absolutely, because you never really get a sense of what's going on behind the scenes. The way the mafia works is it would rather make money than make headlines. How does it make money? It extorts. It's the age-old racket, the shakedown racket. They call it protection, but it's actually truly extortion. So that means that most of the merchants, these would be hotels, shops, cigarette shops, car dealerships, gas stations, restaurants, all have to fork over. Generally, it's a monthly cash payment. Sometimes it's every 6 months. And that leaves the merchant without his shop being burnt down. Or ultimately, a guy can get killed. And it's happened in a number of cases of refuseniks, people that said, no, I'm not going to pay the extortion. And after many threats and character assassination and all kinds of horrible things, animal heads left at his doorstep, he has gotten killed. Now, there is quite a strong anti-mafia movement, and in my introduction, I have a website for those that want to responsibly travel over there and not see their money going to the mafia, filter to the mafia. It lists all of the merchants that have refused. So finally, they've gotten brave enough and just sick of it enough that they're standing up to it. But if you're going over there just as a typical tourist and you're in Palermo, the capital city, to see the beautiful cathedral or some of the great museums or just to experience the fabulous restaurants, it's not like you're going to see mafia assassinations happening in the streets. It's completely on the other side of the divide.
Interesting. I was just wondering, I'm sorry, Patrice, did you have more to add to that?
Oh, not at all. Vernell, if you'd like to ask a question, please, that would be great.
Well, I just wanted to kind of piggyback off of what Carl just said.
Great.
And your book mentions a lieutenant colonel of the Carabinieri Italian National Police Force, Giuseppe Russo, and his efforts to investigate the mafia and his assassination. The gentleman was a native of Siracusa. Am I saying that properly?
Siracusa, yeah, beautiful mountain village.
He lived there with his family. He served as a commander of the mafia unit in Palermo. Funding of the Garcia Dam and the Corleone, I can't say his name.
Yeah, Corleone, very good.
Yeah, efforts regarding intimidation on contracts were subjects of investigation interest. Colonel Russo and fellow law officer Filippo Costa were gunned down in 1977, and Russo's little girl witnessed the shooting. Have you always been interested in the I'm a native Chicagoan, and so I grew up with the Al Capone and Elliot Ness syndromes and different things, so I
right.
was always fascinated. Have you always been interested in mafia?
No. Now, when I was a little kid, of course, the Godfather movies were just a smash success, and they are great films. And so there was sort of mafia fever. If you turned on a comedy show, Carol Burnett or something, they'd be doing a spoof of the Godfather. You'd see the gangsters in their pinstripe suits and all that. At the time, I remember I read two books on the American mafia, and then I forgot all about it, or I lost interest in it. It wasn't something that I necessarily wanted to pursue. I was still in school. And one thing that I always did enjoy, though, growing up in a Northern California town, was going up to the mountain cemetery, and where I grew up in the wine country, there was a lot of Italian farmers and pioneers that were buried in this town, and all of them had photographs. That's the Italian style, or a lot of European cemeteries have the photographs of the deceased on it. And that was something that was always fascinating. So when I started going to Sicily and tromping around the cemeteries like I like to do, it sort of got a reminiscent feeling from my youth, and it was just so fascinating that here I was again looking for various names that I might know, not from my hometown's history, but from the people that I had learned about being assassinated, or some of the Godfathers, some of the bosses. So it truly wasn't until I discovered what a great place Sicily was and the fact that they're still being exploited and oppressed by the current iteration of the mafia that I became interested again. And, of course, that sort of smashed all of my old-fashioned impressions and Hollywood impressions of what the mafia is. Because over there, they're not flashy. You know, you have fugitives, several bosses that are on the run, and if they go around in fancy suits and fancy cars, they're going to get caught pretty quickly. So it's always funny when you see police footage of some of these bosses and surveillance footage. They kind of look slobby. They'll be wearing sweatpants and a polo shirt, and usually you can tell they eat too much, and they're the opposite of your Hollywood version of a gangster. But that's just because they have to blend in.
Wow. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So, Patrice, did you find out any more information regarding the Pope and disconnect?
I did, and just very quickly, you know, from your details, you noted that one of the major mafioso, it was, I believe, Bernardo Provenzano, was living like a monk. Provenzano living like a monk is a direct quote from your book, when apprehended in a hamlet. But now, back to The Godfather, in the hamlet was a cassette tape of the soundtrack of Godfather Part 2. Now,
yes.
Do you think the Sicilian Mafia really approved of the Godfather series directed by Francis Ford Coppola or the Mario Puzo book? Because there are at least two references in your book of Mafia either watching the movie or hearing the music.
It's amazing how enamored these guys are of their own fake mythology. Corleone is the town that is in the Godfather book by Mario Puzo. And in fact, the boss that you mentioned, Godfather Bernardo Provenzano, who had been on the run since 1963, was captured in 2006. That's when I started the book, because I arrived on the island just a week after they captured him. He had been living like a monk. In two ways. It was in this little cheese-making shack up on the mountain overlooking Corleone, which has always been a mafia stronghold. But for so many years, the police didn't even know that he was alive. But he was also extremely religious. His own perverted form of Catholicism, yes, but he had crosses around his on his neck. He had Bibles that were annotated with his own notes. He had posters of the saints and Virgin Mary up on the wall. So it was really strange that when the police busted in and found this guy, he was just sort of smiling like he was an enlightened monk or something. And yes, they found the soundtrack to The Godfather Part 2. It's just amazing that when they capture these guys, how often they find something like that. They'll find a video cassette of a biography of one of their own mafia bosses. Sometimes they will play that soundtrack from the Godfather movies at the weddings. There's a case in Naples, a different mafia, where the boss actually built a home to look like Al Pacino's home in Scarface. There was another one, we just captured this year, a boss in Sicily, whose nickname was Scarface. So they really are enamored with that image. And, you know, they love the guns. They always find arsenals of amazing AK-47s and all kinds of bombs, grenades. So even though they don't go around in limousines, they still believe in that mythology.
Wow, fascinating. And, Vernell, thank you so much. On to that very strong topical question. The Pope recently excommunicated all mafia members. Will it help defeat the mafia? And the coverage is really quite something. You've mentioned very interesting vignettes about the mafia and their alleged devotion. They probably personally believe that they're very devoted to the Catholic Church. But one article from June 23, 2014, by Delia Gallagher, CNN, notes, and I'm citing directly, using his strongest language to date, Pope Francis told Italian mafia members on Saturday that they are excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And just further citing his direct quote, those who in their life have gone along the evil ways, as in the case of the mafia, they are not with God, they are excommunicated, end quote. Francis said in an outdoor mass in Piana di Sabari, Calabria, and that's that's the end quoting of that article. That's fascinating. That sounds like the area, one of the key areas there. You were researching the heart, the Costa Nostra. Do you think that they'll mend their ways? What do you think?
Well, first of all, that was a big blow to mafiosi, mafia members, because they do all consider themselves Catholic. They all go to Mass. They get married in a church. And the Pope, yes, he not just put down this edict that the mafia members are excommunicated from the church. He actually went to Calabria. That is north of Sicily on the mainland. If you're looking at the map of Italy, that's the toe of the boot of Italy and a true mafia hotspot. The mafia there, called the 'Ndrangheta, is actually responsible for bringing in Europe's cocaine from South America. It comes right into the port there. And very dangerous, very violent. I wouldn't try to write the same kind of book in that region. But the Pope actually went down there and spoke out against it. Here's what I think he's trying to do. If you go to a village, generally you have a mafia village, that is, and most Italians, most Sicilians are not mafia members, we have to say. The two authority figures there are the priest and the mafia boss. To a lesser extent, the mayor of the town is, but in more cases than not, that mayor has been corrupted and installed by the mafia simply because the mafia boss can tell the people of the village how to vote. And so, you know, they get a lot of exchange of favors from the politician when they install their own guy there. That way they can get their hands on public monies, public project money, and control hiring on building a hospital or something. And in turn, when they get busted, they can expect the politician to go to bat for them. So what I think Pope Francis is doing by excommunicating all these mafia members is driving a wedge between the local churches and the mafia. Because in a sense, he's saying the mafia is completely powerless now because they can't count on the church. The priest who may have always looked the other way now might be implicated. At least he can no longer speak out against this. One problem that they've had since Pope Francis did this excommunication is the old traditions that are dying hard have made the news. So the old tradition of the church procession of a funeral going through the town, they would always stop at the boss's house, carrying the Virgin Mary, big statue of her, and they would actually have the Virgin sort of bow in the direction of the boss. Even if the boss is in prison, they still pay their respects with the processions, and not necessarily even a funeral, but just the religious processions in general. And so after Pope Francis did this excommunication, on three occasions now it has made the news that they're still trying to pay obeisance to the local boss, most notably one who was a mass murderer, basically, in prison. He wasn't home at the time. Another one in Sicily, in a small town there, instead of stopping at the boss's house, they stopped in front of the business, the funeral home that he ordered, that he owned, and they paid their respects there. Now, it's just atrocious behavior. And the Pope, by putting a spotlight on this and having the journalists rush to these towns now, I think little by little it's going to work. It's going to at least keep a mafia member from getting married in a church or from getting a church funeral. And there have been a number of cases where actual former hitmen or extortioners have actually just repented and felt that what they were doing was wrong. And I think the Pope was also reaching out to those people that might have been teetering on the edge of thinking about collaborating with the police.
Oh, this is just more and more intriguing as we listen. I also read something, Patrice, and I just want to know what you thought about this too, Carl. The editorial board of July 14th, quoting directly, Pope Francis is showing that he means business, foul fiduciary business, in his campaign to clean up the Vatican Bank. And since the Pope made his promise of credible reform last year, investigators and bank officials have vetted and closed out 3,000 suspect and unwanted accounts. What do you think that means? I mean, the finances are kind of a touchy subject there, I'm sure.
Yeah, the Vatican Bank was an issue in Godfather 3, if you saw that movie. The problem with the Vatican Bank is the low security. So it's not that the bankers there in the Vatican are necessarily mafia members, but what it is a money launderer's dream. So it's so easy to get money in and out of there. Last year, they busted a priest. They call him Monsignor Cinquecento, which is basically like a Father 500, because he had suitcases full of 500 euro bills that he was smuggling to Switzerland. This has been a problem for so long. Just because the security is so porous, Pope Francis finally said, you know what, we're going to shore up the security, we're going to change everything there. All indications are that's exactly what's happening now, because it was such a stain on the church for so long. But this is the first time I think that a pope has actually done what he said about the Vatican Bank.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, regarding and unsavory, like, of course, most priests, I'm sure, are very God-fearing and do the best to serve the Lord. But there can be exceptions. And, again, this is a mere allegation, what I'm about to note here. The article is entitled Prosecutors Investigate Vatican Bank Mafia Link. Anti-mafia prosecutors have asked the secretive Vatican Bank to disclose details of an account held by a priest in connection with a money laundering and fraud investigation. It emerged on Sunday. Now, it's a bit of a dated article. It's June 10th, 2012, and I wanted to note the internet link on that. Oh, yes, it's at www.telegraph.co.uk, the Telegraph, citing directly. Oh, heavens. Let me see. Oh, here it is. Again, the journalist Nick Pisa. Quoting, the official request was made more than a month ago, but so far, the Vatican Bank, known as the Institute for Religious Works, has refused to disclose any records of the account held by Father Nini Trepieti, who is currently suspended from serving as a priest. Investigators want to know more about vast sums of money that are said to have passed through his account to establish if they were money laundering operations by On the Run, Mafia Godfather Matteo Messina Denaro, end quote. And you have some very interesting accounts there on the Godfather Matteo Messina Denaro. Do I remember correctly? He's a rather a dashing figure. He's still at large.
He was back before he was turned out to be Italy's most wanted mafia member. Yes, Matteo Messina Denaro. He was one of the exceptions. He was pretty flashy, and he loved his Porsches. Now, because the entire world is after him, or at least the law enforcement, he is on the run because he's kind of considered a job creator in his own hometown. He's on the west coast of Sicily, in the province of Trapani. There's so much secrecy around him that the locals there kind of protect him. They think that he's probably still in Sicily. Not everybody is of that opinion, but the fact that he has been, you know, for a couple of decades now sought after, nobody knows. But yeah, Matteo Messina Denaro, he became a billionaire. He's sort of a neo-mafia boss, the new mafia. He didn't do it through some of the older practices. He would actually launder money through legitimate companies, and this is what the mafias of northern Italy are doing too. So he sunk money, laundered money, that is, through green power. So if you go to Sicily now, you see a lot of wind turbines. Wind power. He did it through a huge chain of supermarkets. And, of course, the locals sort of thanked him for all the jobs they got as the stock boys and cashiers and that sort of thing. So that's how he's protected. But a multi-billionaire, and they've captured some of his family members and some of his closest underbosses around him just in the last year or so. But they're still hot on the trail of Matteo Messina Denaro. I went to the town, his hometown, Castelvetrano, and I took a picture of the family crypt, the tomb. It's a sort of one of those stone and marble mausoleums that you see in a cemetery. It looks like a little house. And it was very well known as the place where his father was buried. He was the old godfather before he died. And so Mateo's mother and either sister or some of the other women in the family visit the cemetery every week. And while I was there, here she came, and she, quite infamously in her black dress, or her mourning dress, even though her husband died in 1998, they still visit the tomb, they bring flowers, and I had to wait it out. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't take a picture of her, I just wanted to get the picture of the tomb because I'm not a paparazzo. So that's in the book, and it's actually the first published photograph of the Mateo, of the Messina Denaro family's tomb anywhere, whether in book or online. I think if I'm going to anger anybody in the mafia for any reason in my book, I'm not exposing any mafia secrets. It's my work is all based on past research. But I think the fact that I pointed out and published this photograph of the family tomb that probably will not endear me to the Messina Denaro family.
Well, to that end, I'd like to know, do you feel any type of intimidation, or are you apprehensive of any type of retaliation based on the information you've gathered?
No, because the mafia is not going to come out to California and try and assassinate me. You know, it wouldn't be worth it. Nobody's going to go to prison because of my book. Now, I've gotten emails, some nasty emails. I had a photograph of a restaurant on my blog. It's not in my book. By a guy who restaurants owned by a guy who did prison time as a mafia associate, but he was released. And he sent me a couple dozen emails. Some were angry. Some were pleading to take down this photograph. It's actually a pretty well-known restaurant in Palermo. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave it up and see what happens, because this restaurant was very well known, especially around the early 2000s, for being a hangout of the mafia bosses and the sons of the mafia bosses who were becoming bosses themselves. It was a true mafia landmark. But he sent me his acquittal papers that the court gave him, you know, when they released him. And he was acquitted by law. Now I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, mafia bosses, they get acquitted, mafia members get acquitted, and then they arrest them a few years later back and forth. But then I started thinking, you know, I'm not a judge here. Maybe he really was, you know, not a mafia associate. So because he pointed out that he was responsible for a couple of dozen restaurant employees, please take it down. I took it down. And also, you don't know how far something's going to go. I think just the fact that I'm exposing some of these places is going to anger people, as I mentioned, but I'm not worried for my safety. You will not find a photograph of me online, though, because I would like to continue to go to Sicily, because it's my favorite place in the world.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Well, I just have one other question on that point, and like I said, I'm a native Chicagoan, and of course that whole deal, but more to the end that I spent some time with family in Detroit, and of course you have heard about the Jimmy Hoffa situation. Do mafia members do they converse unlike our legal people who don't know what the other one is doing? I mean, is there any way that somebody in the Sicilian mafia might know what any information regarding the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa?
Well, not in Sicily, no. That's a whole other voluminous subject of study, and I'm not an expert on the American mafia. They have their own. They have a couple of guys that went missing over there, and they still to this day don't know where they are. But there's various rumors about it. But yeah, a situation like that where the mafia gets involved with the trade unions, as they have in New York and Detroit and Chicago, of course, they have their own versions of that. Generally, though, they stick to the politicians, corrupting them. And one of the Catholic Church's main political parties of the at least the second half of the 20th century, the political party called the Christian Democrats.
Yes.
They completely corrupted them so that you had the mayor of Palermo, a Christian Democrat, and his development czar completely tearing down the whole green belt of Palermo, tearing down these beautiful old 18th, 19th century mansions and putting up these awful mafia-controlled construction projects. So it's a real unfortunate part of the city when you see these mid-rises and high-rises. So corrupting through the politicians, getting their hands on the money, the public money for, well, I mentioned a hospital a little while ago in southern Sicily, in the town of Agrigento, which is known for its Greek temples. The mafia got a hold of a contract to build a hospital, and they call it the Hospital of Sand because brand new, it was already collapsing. They put so much sand in the cheap concrete that they had to condemn it. You know, just stuff like that. That's how they work. There are parallels to the American mafia corrupting the trade unions, but over there it's more going directly to the politicians.
You know, your book really references many of the different interactions. For example, you mentioned Judge Terranova. He was a mafia shooting assassination victim. And to quote directly, few in law enforcement knew the makeup and method of Cosa Nostra like Terranova. He filled volumes with analyses of the phenomenon. Elected to Parliament in 1972, he went to Rome and served on the Anti-Mafia Commission to focus on the criminal infiltration of politics. As the influence of the Sicilian Mafia spread to Italy's capital, Terranova urged the compromised Christian Democrat Party to put its house in order, end quote. One of several references in your book to very brave judges and also law enforcement officials being assassinated, in this case by shooting, in other cases by bombs.
Yeah, that was a real unfortunate era, a couple of decades. The Corleonese, the mafia from Corleone, right in the middle of the island, took over the Palermo mafia to become the most powerful mafia at the time. And this was from the early 70s to the early 90s. Bernardo Provenzano's partner was probably the most vicious of all Sicilian mafia bosses. His name was Totorina. And he waged war on the Italian state directly. His method was just kill them all. So not only did he kill all of his rivals in the Palermo mafia, he went after guys like Judge Terranova and other anti-mafia judges. He went after politicians, the good ones, assassinated them in cold blood. He went after journalists that were trying to track them and expose their deals. He went after even just anti-mafia activists. And so probably to the tune of about 1,000 assassinations just in that time. And it culminated in 1992 with the blowing up of the two top anti-mafia magistrates, Paolo Borsellino and Giovanni Falcone. Those two judges, they had the mafia's number. They weren't supported by their superiors because there was some corruption. Turns out there were some moles lurking around in their offices. But they figured out all of the charts, the corporate charts. They drew lines to all the connections, doing this without the benefit of a computer, but actually just poring over endless banking statements and recording phone conversations, following these guys around, seeing who was who. So the mafia knew that these two guys were their biggest threat because they were actually rounding up mafia bosses. They got about 400 mafia bosses. They built this bomb-proof courthouse in Palermo, which still stands, under the old 200-year-old prison, this big concrete bunker. They put all of these bosses in cages around the courtroom and put them on trial. And what's more, they convicted them, they imprisoned them, and they passed new laws that said these bosses could no longer have visitors because just like in America, a crime boss can continue to conduct business from behind bars through the family that visits or through his visiting attorney and that sort of thing. So they cut him off, and this outraged Totorina, who was a fugitive at the time. And that's when he blew up these two bosses. And eventually, the people of Italy, and especially Sicily, said no more. For the first time ever, they started to stand up. They took to the streets marching. They hung anti-mafia slogans from bedsheets from their balconies. I'm just unprecedented, because it was so dangerous before, but they said enough is enough. And they finally found this boss, Totorina, and they caught him in 1993. He's still in prison, and he's on trial for all of these various murders. Right now, the most incredible, it's really the trial of the century, as these various investigators track the connections between the politicians, going all the way up to a couple of complete prime ministers in Roman Parliament. Berlusconi, you probably know him for his sex scandals, but they found that he was on the receiving end of mafia money when he was starting off his empire and construction in the early 70s. He turned out to be Italy's richest man, was the prime minister of Italy for four times, and also controlled the majority of the media over there. So you had the most convoluted trial still going on. I sort of cover the beginning of it, but my book did come out this year, but it continues, and I'm trying to just follow it all. You have politicians on trial, ex-politicians, Berlusconi's very close friend who facilitated the mafia hookup, Marcello Dell'Utri, who was a senator in Berlusconi's party. He's doing time for mafia association fees, so he'll be in prison for the next 6.5 years. And they keep uncovering more and more. It turns out that there were a couple of police officers, very elite, the Carabinieri, which is Italy's militarized state police force. Back during these horrible bombings and assassinations, they tried to reach out to the mafia and say, let's make a deal. What can we do to end all of these killings? Some kind of ceasefire. So that's part of what this trial is going on now. They call it the State Mafia Pact. They're investigating to what extent the certain representatives of the Italian government tried to cut a deal with the mafia to effect a ceasefire. This is very convoluted, and I cover it in my blog, and it's just too deep to even go any further about it right now. But right now it seems like justice is little by little being served over there. At the same time, there's so much we don't know about the mafia. We only know about them through the busts, and some of the assassinations that take place. But the story continues, and I try to cover it in my blog, mafiaexposed.com.
These are fascinating instances of information that you're sharing. Patrice, did you have something more to add?
Yes. I was going to note that the comments about Silvio Berlusconi and that the topical question, is former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi mafioso, has really interesting response there in the Internet articles. One dated May 12, 2014, posted at the independent.co.uk website, Silvio Berlusconi's links with Italian organized crime confirmed. Former Prime Minister's involvement with the Sicilian Mafia is proven as his middleman to Cosa Nostra arrested. And then quoting directly, Silvio Berlusconi, Italy's former Prime Minister and one of the world's most recognizable politicians, did business with the Mafia for nearly two decades. This is the conclusion of the country's Supreme Court of Cassazione in Rome. The billionaire tycoon, nicknamed the Teflon Don, worked with Cosa Nostra, the Sicilian Mafia, via his conduit and former Senator Marcello Dell'Utri, after judges sentenced Dell'Utri to 7 years for mafia association, end quote. Very, very timely. That blog is excellent.
Yeah. And you quoted from a couple of very good British newspapers, too, that covered this. Yeah, looking back, it was around 1972 that Berlusconi had a meeting with the actual top drug kingpin of Sicily, a guy by the name of Stefano Bontate, very powerful. He was pretty instrumental in the pizza connection. So they were bringing Asian heroin, refining it in Sicily, and sending it to the U.S., selling it out of pizzerias on the east coast of the U.S. So that was the famous pizza connection that was busted up. So godfather Bontate gave a bunch of money to Berlusconi and got him started on his career. And that was done, as you mentioned from the article, Marcello Dell'Utri, his very good friend who became the senator, who's doing time now. He also installed a Palermo mafia killer on Berlusconi's estate in Milan. So his job title was stableman, you know, take care of Berlusconi's horses. But in fact, he was a hitman. And I think pretty much from all corners, everyone agrees that it was because when you're that rich, when you're Berlusconi, it's always a good idea to have a guy who's not afraid to kill for you as your bodyguard. So pretty much everyone agrees that he was really there as a protector, a bodyguard of Berlusconi. So we'll see. Berlusconi last year was put on trial for mafia association. He was acquitted of those charges. However, they did find him guilty of tax fraud in the grossest possible way. He's also just yesterday finally acquitted of the underage hooker scandal, but everyone around him is also tainted, and he had such a sleazy setup in his party house on the island of Sardinia that the accusations are going to go on for a long time.
You know, I did have a question. Is it okay for me to go ahead, or are you ready to move to the next? Well, on the topic of the mafia and its links around, you know, the world other than just in Sicily, do you have any thoughts or observations that you could share with the listeners about its links to Cuba and South American organized crime?
Yeah, it used to be, when I mentioned the pizza connection, that the heroin, some cocaine, was going westward to the U.S. But now, because the Calabrian mafia from the mainland province of Calabria is a more powerful mafia, it's a reverse drug pipeline. So they're bringing in South American cocaine and distributing it through the rest of Europe. But the Calabrians have also infiltrated the UK, Spain, Germany. The Sicilian fugitive, that number one fugitive, Matteo Messina Denaro, was also found just recently to have some connections in banks in Venezuela, so using fake bank certificates, getting a line of credit there. So there is some cross-cooperation between the Sicilians and the Calabrians. But right now, it seems to be that as the mafia continues to grow, they've always called it the octopus, but its tentacles really are just traveling so far around the world. We haven't even mentioned Canada. The Canadian mafias of Toronto, Montreal, had their Sicilian roots, but right now, those are probably some of the most dangerous mafias on this hemisphere, more so than anything you're going to find in New York or some of the more traditional mafia areas. Economic policy groups, did a study, maybe it was about 6 months ago, that found that all told, the mafia is more profitable than all of the EU countries combined. So all of the European Union is not as rich as the mafia because they have gotten so far in their legitimate businesses simply as a money laundering ploy.
Fascinating information. You were mentioning, too, the Sicilian connection, not only with the New York and families and other mafia presence in the United States, but also linking some of the Sicilian members in Canada. Very interesting reporting. Also, you know, something that I thought is very powerful vignette, you mentioned the Palermo Airport being situated in a rather dangerous location by the mountains there. It's named Falcone Borsellino in honor of as you mentioned, have already described the two anti-mafia magistrates assassinated by bombs in 1992. Also, Carl, you do a great job in referencing legislation passed in Italy against the mafia activity in, as a result of these judiciary officers' deaths. And from a great article in 1992, it was again in the independent.co.uk, entitled Italy Passes Anti-Mafia Law, quoting directly from Reuters, the Italian Parliament passed a package of tough anti-mafia measures aimed at strengthening the state's hand following the recent murders of two leading judges. The package, which gives the police wider powers, including use of undercover sting operations, wiretaps, and infiltrators, was approved by an overwhelming majority, end quote. And, you know, I just doing brief research, there's been subsequent legislation, and there's also a European Union official really commending Italy for its passing of strong laws. Italy may turn out to really be a pioneer in passing this type of legislation.
Yeah, they certainly have, and it really seems to work because these guys are constantly fighting to be, you know, to get visitors and that sort of thing. In fact, Totorina, the big bad boss who's been in prison since 1993, was recently caught on tape talking to a boss from mainland Italy, talking about how he wants to kill the current anti-mafia prosecutors and the current judges that are still on his tail and putting him up on trial. There's this one prosecutor who believes that he knew he was being recorded. And he was saying, we got to do a big thing like the good old days in Palermo. You know, we got to make them dance the samba, meaning we got to blow these guys up. In fact, he even mentioned dynamite. So one of the prosecutors named Nicola Ingroia feels that Rina knew that he was on tape and he was trying to get a message out to the current mafia because he can't have visitors. Maybe this was a message to let's go after the current guys just like we did 20, 25 years ago. So there's sort of a heightened sense of tension around the Palermo courthouse. They found that some of the mafia files from past trials were just left very haphazardly and very easy for someone to access. I posted a video from a journalist who walked into the courthouse, went up to the third floor, picked up some mafia files, legal files, walked out. They're filming this. Of course, they returned them, but it shows you that it's not that difficult for the mafia to really, you know, strike up its old tune again. So right now you find a movement to get these guys, these judges, more protection. There's always a budget crisis too because Italy was hit hard. It still hasn't recovered from the 2008 recession. So in so many ways, it's quite broke. And so you have citizens now, anti-mafia activists, that go and stand in front of the courthouse. They call them civic bodyguards or civic escorts. And it's more symbolic than anything, but they stand there out in front of the courthouse to back up these anti-mafia judges who have been threatened.
Well, I also would like to, my last question would be, regarding prior eras, you mentioned very interesting details on American and Sicilia, major mafia conferences held in Sicily. You also mentioned the high regard of American mafia figures of Sicilian family origin when they visited Italy. I'm wondering if I remember the details correctly. Charles Lucky Luciano, when he was extradited from the United States, was really feted in Sicily, with people just tremendously impressed. Any comments on that? It's rather a rambling question.
I didn't hear the last part of that question.
Impressed. He was really celebrated there.
Well, yes, in Sicily, in a little village called Lercara Fridi. Beautiful little town, but he made it big over in America, structure to the American mafia, the five families of New York, so-called. And because it was so structured, he came to the fore during Prohibition, which was just perfect for any burgeoning gangster. So when he returned to Italy, deported after his prison sentence, he went back a hero. He went to his hometown, and in the piazza there, there's a photograph of in my book, they had a big dinner for him, and they called him Your Excellency. You know, he was a celebrity. They didn't ever have a celebrity, I guess, in Mercato Fridi.
That brings me to a quick question. Both Patrice and I were having regarding celebrities, and I have rumors travel, but do you think there was ever any real truth to those things that were being said about our loved, what's his name, Patrice? We were just talking about
Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
That Cuba conference.
Interesting. Yes, absolutely. Sinatra did hang around with gangsters. They caught him on film down in Cuba, down in Havana, sort of carousing around the casinos. Interestingly, and this is in my book too, not to keep plugging it, but Sinatra's family and Lucky Luciano's family lived on the same block together in this little town. So when Luciano was a boy, it was Sinatra's grandparents who lived up the block there. There's a plaque on the Sinatra home. There's nothing on the Luciano home. That took a while. I actually found that. So that this is an exclusive in this book, Lucky Luciano's childhood home, which is in very poor shape. There's an old woman who lives on the top floor, but the bottom floor is just abandoned. It looked like, I think I saw beer cans in there, sort of just a real hovel right now. But yes, absolutely. They found Lucky Luciano's phone number in Frank Sinatra's address book. So what more proof do you need than that?
Wow. So there must be some truth to the things that Sammy Davis Jr. was trying to get exposed before he passed.
I can't speak to that. I haven't studied that.
Well, yeah, it's been pretty hushed up. He's sort of been blacklisted. It's like he never was, they've put a block on all his movies and, anything using his name, apparently for taxes, from what I understand.
Well, it certainly wouldn't surprise me.
That's an interesting point. One thing that worries me is that there is a glamorous mystique to the mafia, and indeed, I've always enjoyed viewing The Godfather. But by the same token, it would be upsetting if our younger generations would seriously consider following that path. Do you think some of the mystique after the research regarding the killings and the illegal and harmful entanglements with government have been made known may prevent these young people from wanting to join, or do you think that family tradition is going to survive?
Well, I tell you, Patrice, down there, because unemployment is so high, it's among youth, it's 50%. So half the young people are out of a job. And when you are suddenly offered a job with the local clan, it's pretty irresistible. It's a problem. It was a problem for me looking for these locations because I stuck out driving around in my rental car with my camera. On every corner, there are a bunch of guys. Now, chances are most of those guys are just hanging out, but you don't know who are the eyes and ears of the mafia. Yes, it is pretty irresistible, and that's why Italy puts a lot of money into school programs from the very young. They have a lot of these anti-mafia judges, just the activists, go to speak to the kids and, let them know. And with assassinations, a lot of them are aware of the dangers of it and just the despicable nature of the mafia. But still, yeah, it'll be a draw. And, movies, even an anti-mafia movie like an anti-war film still kind of glamorizes it. So I think that the media, plays into it, unfortunately.
Well, I remember one of my schools was Catholic, and actually two of them were, and one of my roommates was a gal whose family was from the mafia in New York. I remember her as being very academic. She was very devout. She certainly was a nice roommate. But secondly, I'd like to go to some of more of your book's excellent details regarding the mafia wars, of course, all the horrible crimes that were involved in the counts there against the defendants. That social phenomena, I'm trying to think if I have the correct term here, the mega or mass trials and also the major wars in Sicily.
Yeah, the Maxi trials. That was when they put all those bosses in cages. And if you go to YouTube and actually just search Maxi trials, you'll see them. One of the godfathers there, they called him the Pope. He died a few years ago. He was always known for carrying his Bible around. And he does this sort of strange threat. He, just as they were about to decide his verdict, he said, "May you have peace for the rest of your days based on your decision." It was really, really an amazing, for somebody to, anyone who doesn't speak Italian, you won't get quite the threat, but it's just amazing. The Mafia Wars, the two Mafia Wars, one is Italy's war on the Mafia and vice versa, but also to this day you still have, when one boss gets arrested for extortion, you still have the next guy who wants to take over and continue to shake down the merchants. So the struggle continues, but I think that at least for the Sicilian Mafia, it's as weak as it ever has been in its roughly century and a half history.
You know, that's fascinating. So many very brave Cavalieri and other, and of course the judiciary there. You know, Carl, your material in the blog and your book is truly excellent. And again, I wanted to note your website can be found at www.mafiaexposed.com. Your book is entitled The Sicilian Mafia, A True Crime Travel Guide. And the details can be found at that site as well. It's a fascinating read. Now, any final comments, and then to Carl.
Well, Carl, thank you again. I echo Patrice's sentiments. We hope that you will consider being a guest on our show again. Would you like to, you know, do a shout-out to anybody special or give us an update on your next book signing?
Okay, well, I just finished a little book tour. I will do a shout-out, though. It's my long-suffering girlfriend who stuck with me all of these years, and she's waiting for me now as we're in San Francisco, so we're going to go get something to eat. And she has to suffer through a lot of these interviews and book signings, and for so many years, she says, all I could see of you was your back, because this was so research-heavy. The bibliography is 4 pages long, and that's just, you know, that's not even a complete one. So it was a big relief to get this out. So anyone can contact me through MafiaExposed.com. Of course, I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I'm happy to respond personally. Thank you guys for having me on the show.
Thank you,
Carl. Well, everyone, have a wonderful weekend. Thanks again to our wonderful guest. And
Patrice,
we appreciate your listening. Thank you again, Carl. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, Patrice and Vernell. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Carl. So, Patrice, is there anything we can share with our audience or our listeners for our next guest next Saturday?
Yes, indeed, we can. Let me just get up this page here. It is on cybersecurity. And I believe the gentleman's name is Doc Nucitelli. We'll get further information here. Let me just very quickly go into this. I want to make sure that I have the correct, because we have another wonderful show, Voice of the People, I believe, following us now. And I believe the gentleman's name, who will be our guest, is Doc Nucitelli. He is a world-class cybersecurity expert. And let me just very quickly confirm that, and then we'll have to say adieu, because I don't want to keep that next show waiting. Greg has a file. Let me just see if I can bring it up. Let me see. Yes, indeed. Doc Nucitelli, it should be a fascinating show, as this one was absolutely fascinating. Everyone, have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much for now. Always love having your wonderful, wonderful host, and I'm so proud to be on our Global Newsmaker Focus team with you. Great
My
weekend,
pleasure, Patrice.
And thank you to Joe for both taping and broadcasting this interview. Bye-bye.
'cause I get a good feeling. Yeah.
Stars. Here we go. Cause I'm a freak. Yeah, I'm a freak. Cause I'm a freak. Yeah, I'm a freak.
Baby, you pop it and lock it, drop it, I watch it for show. Baby, you roll it and rock it, move it, I use it, let's go. You know I lick it and do the things that'll make you explode. You don't believe me, mommy, just let me go low. Because I'm a freak, 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 that you know. Now can I get a beep, 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 baby, back it up nice and slow. I just wanna skate, 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 right out and go. I came, I saw, I conquered, off to the next.
Let's yeah, go. I'm a freak, the way you pop it and drop it all over me. No, I don't want you to stop it. Yeah, I'm a freak, baby, I can't lie. When you move like that, I got a one-track mind. Cause I'm a freak. Yeah, I'm a freak. Cause I'm a freak. Yeah, I'm a freak.
It's the Catter.
From the hotel room to the DJ booth, on the bathroom seat, yes, I'm just a freak. And when the sun goes down, gotta let it out. Baby, don't blame me, I'm just a freak.
Thank you.
Chili's, fresh is now. Kraft burgers, fresh ingredients. Made to order when you order. So you can devour it right about now. The new sweet and smoky burger at the new Chili's, where fresh is happening now.
Washington. He was looking for a throne to steal. He wanted to bind his frame of mind to America's New Deal. When he came upon this patriot on the guitar playing it hot, Obama jumped up a political stump and said, "Joe, I'll tell you what. I'll bet you hadn't heard that I'm a guitar player too. And if you care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play a pretty good guitar, boy, but give Obama his due. I'll bet the nation sold whose throne I stole. I'm a better player than you." Joe said, "My name's not Boy Man, and I'm ready to rebel. But I'll take your bet and your veiled threat if it'll break your evil spell."
Joe, grab your Stratocaster and play your fingers hard, 'cause hell's broke loose in D.C. and Obama holds the cards. And if he wins the minds of men, the damage is untold. But if you win, the devil could be unthroned.
Obama grabbed his Telecaster and said, "I'll start this test." And fire flew from his fingertips as he unbuttoned his president's vest. Then he kissed his magic guitar pick, and it made an evil hiss. And a band of politicians joined in, and it sounded something like this. Finished, Joe said, "Well, you're pretty good, Hussein, but sit right there with that arrogant glare till I finished up my playing." He played.
Obama's in D.C., run, boys, run. The devil in the White House ain't no fun. Chickens in Congress taking our dough. Granny got Medicare, no child, no.
palm about his head because he knew that he'd been bound. And he laid his silly rubber mask before Joe upon the ground. Joe said, "Obama, please get lost and don't you ever come back again. We done told you once, you socialist pawn, you ain't our nation's friend."
He played
Obama's in D.C., run, boys, run. The devil in the White House ain't no fun. Chickens in Congress taking our dough. Granny gun, Medicare, no child, no.
What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Temperatures rising and the whole world uniting against us and the things that we've done. With Iraq flattened like downtown Manhattan, it's the end of our time. Banks are imploding, Afghans are exploding, the debt rises higher each day. But with crazy distortions and logic contortions, blame it all on Obama, some say. But peak oil's a-coming, can't keep our cars running, and our public schools are a joke. Detroit's a ghost town, the factories closed down, American industry's broke. We take money from China so we can all live finer while they torture folks in plain sight. Still some folks are saying the solution is praying and moving us all to the right. If I die to be a dumbass, watching Rush Limbaugh, they're going to class. When your country needs you, you tell them that you're through, cause you don't like the bill they just passed. If I die to be a dumbass.
I don't trust maps or computer models.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cashless. Well, unemployment's rising. It's ticked up once again. It stands at 9.8% and soon it will be 10. And we're in Obama's prison. We're underneath his curse. And he ain't doing nothing but making things far worse. Jobs are disappearing. Obama, he don't mind. He'd rather ruin health care and leave us in a bind. Yes, we're in Obama's prison, where socialism rules. And the government is run by a bunch of liberal fools.
Now, wait a minute, Johnny. That's not fair. I, Barack Obama, understand the problems with our economy.
Yeah, you should. You're responsible for most of them.
Johnny, I don't know what you're talking about. My policies, like cap and trade, will get American industry moving.
Yeah, to other countries.
What about my stimulus bill?
Hey, Barack, stimulate this. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, never trust a Marxist. Now we've elected one, and I knew we had it coming. I know we can't be free. When the Democrats are wrecking our economy. My name is Sue. How do you do?
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how their protests used to make me smile. 'Cause I knew we could ram it through before they ever had a clue. Then maybe they'd shut up for a while. But the protest grew and made me shiver. Pelosi and Reid could not deliver. Now our push for health care would have to wait till September, October, or next year. I can't remember if I cried when I heard the riot organized. But something told me deep inside that day, national health care died.
People have been having these rallies. You would think they would be saying thank you.
We gotta watch American Idol. Wait for him to deliver. We gotta check our Facebook status. We gotta watch reality TV. Look at that, look at that. I should have read the Constitution. I should have learned some history. Look at that Congress, they just stick it to American man, and we get taxed some more. And she's up there, what's that screeching noises? Shredding the Constitution like a crazy banshee. Oh, this ain't working, but that's the way they do it. Get your money up for nothing, spread the wealth to me. We gotta watch American Idol, wait for Amazon delivery. Check out Facebook status. We gotta watch reality TV.
Ali.
Apprentice.
Now, Corolla, why did your team lose?
Now, hold on a second. And by the way,
interrupt this program for Obama to say something.
My fellow Americans,
I'd like to announce that I'm running for President of America as a black man this time.
I did some time in jail. I did some crime with Michelle. We stole some fried watermelon.
Yippee-ki-yay.
I'm known to smack up a bitch. I got Kool-Aid in the fridge. I never met my kids. Their real dad is Kanye.
Guns, yeah, sold them.
How'd you get in the White House?
I smoke a lot of Newports. I sit a lot on the porch. I stole 2012 Porsche from my neighbor's driveway. I did a lot of drug deals. I killed Osama for trills. I blamed it on Navy SEALs and fucked his bitch sideways. Bro, yeah, I'm holding. Rock, sweet, meth, and rolling. White House garden showing.
What you think I'm growing, daisies?
Hey, I just met you. No, it's okay.
To look white, I'm smacking ladies, so it's no wonder y'all crackers hate me.
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy.
I'm sorry, I get that from my mother. She's a typical white person.
It's Bobby the Racist Apple.
All right, I got another one. No more racist jokes, Bobby.
It's not racist, I swear.
Okay, let's hear it.
So this apple starts dating a lemon.
Come on, Bobby, no lemon jokes.
Hold on, hold on. It's a really good one. So after a few dates, the lemon starts
dating a long, long time ago,
thinks there might be some potential.
I can still remember.
Proposes to the lemon.
Bobby. So after months of planning and saving up for the wedding, the big day approaches. While the lemon's waiting up on the altar,
Bobby,
someone runs up to her with a note from the apples saying that he chickened out at the last minute and couldn't go through with the wedding.
Bobby!
What?
Finish the fucking joke.
So, several years pass, and no one's heard from the lemon. Finally, are you sure you want me to continue?
Do it.
Okay. After some time, the apple meets up with the lemon at a bar. The apple reluctantly asks her how she's been all these years. To which the lemon responds, I'm still a little bitter.
Yeah, it's true. We can hold a grudge if we want to.
You're Kevin, right?
No, I'm Todd.
Oh, sorry. You lemons all look alike.
Kill him.
Bobby the Racist Apple.
Hey.
racist apple.
Yo, Bobby, you coming to the party on Tuesday?
Oh, yeah, man.
If the South would have won, we'd have had it made. I'd probably run for president of the Southern States. The day Elvis passed away would be our national holiday. If the South would have won, we'd have had it made. I'd make my Supreme Court down in Texas, and we wouldn't have no killers getting off free. If they were proven guilty, then they would swing quickly, instead of writing books and smiling on TV. We'd all learn Cajun cooking in Louisiana, and I'd put that capital back in Alabama. We'd put Florida on the right track, 'cause we'd take Miami back and throw all them pushers in the summer. Oh, if the South would have won, we'd have had it made. I'd probably run for president of the Southern States. The day young Skinner died, we'd show our Southern pride. If the South would have won, we'd have had it made.
A little Dixieland, boy. Oh, yeah.
I'd have all the whiskey made in Tennessee, and all the horses raised in those Kentucky hills. The national treasury would be in Tupelo, Mississippi, and I'd put Hank Williams' picture on $100 bills. I'd have all the cars made in the Carolinas, and I'd ban all the ones made in China. I'd have every girl child sent to Georgia to learn to smile and talk with that Southern accent that drives me wild.
I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But I've been for Cotton Eye Joe. I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?
One more. crazy as my story said, but it's true. I saw many things that I never knew. He loved to party and he loved to dance. He loved to get loud every time he had a chance. I always thought he was a simple-minded okey. Well, little did I know he was the king of karaoke. He was everything that a man should be. The problem was that it wasn't with me. Poor me, poor me, poor me.
You know, it might be fun and intriguing and spicy and all that. You're not helping anybody. You're not accomplishing anything. You know, I know guys.
Are you looking for an internet radio station with a unique blend of talk radio and an eclectic musical flavor? Join Stardust Radio today at www.stardustradio.com, where talent and technology meet.
Have you always wanted to know the truth about things like UFOs, underground bases, Area 51, the Great Pyramid at Giza, and the Roswell incident of 1947? If so, look no further than Dennis Ballfaser's cutting-edge research. There's no woo-woo factor here, folks, just the facts as he researched them. Dennis's lectures are available on video and audio cassette. For more information and free access to Dennis's research, visit his website, www.truthseekeratroswell.com. That's truthseekeratroswell.com. The truth is here.
Climate change could affect our way of life. Reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and help control climate change. Visit www.vcr-mvr.ca. Brought to you by the Voluntary Challenge and Registry, Climate Change Central, and this radio station.
And now live from Riverside, Iowa, the future birthplace of Captain James T. Kirk of the USS Enterprise. Another episode of Wake Up USA, a UFO study. Here.
So the best way to learn any dance is to practice the elements that make up that dance, much like practicing your scales on a piano. If you learn to read music and you learn your scales, you can play any song put in front of you. Same type of thing when it comes to the different styles of swing. If you understand some basic swing elements, you can put them together a lot like Legos to make up the different styles of swing.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use four-letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today.
And it's night today, and black's white today.
And most guys today, the woman fries today.
I just silly gigolo.
And though I'm not a great romancer,
I know you're bound to answer
when we propose. Anything goes.
Go.
Go.
Woo!
black's white today.
And most guys today that women prize today are just silly gigolos.
And though we're not such great romancers, we know that you're bound to answer when we propose.
José. Mira, ya que estás aquí, esta mañana encontré varios descuentos en tu póliza. Yo también chequeo las cosas dos veces.
Bueno, quizá no sean expertos en estar frente a las cámaras, pero cuando se trata de conseguir los descuentos que te mereces, nadie mejor que un agente de State Farm. Mejora tu estado. State Farm.
¿Cuándo? Me sienta tan mal cuando no haya paz. Pensaré en tu amor y en la manera en que esta noche tú.
But you're lovely with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft. There is nothing for me but to love you just the way. Night comes around and I'm still feeling bad.
Rain pouring down,
blinding every hope I had.
Poets often use many words to say a simple thing. It takes thought.
You can hear him cry, oh Lord, heaven knows we belong way down below. Sing it.
Oh Lord, heaven knows we belong way down below, way down below, way down below.
Judy's in the front seat picking up trash, living on the dole, gotta make that cash. Won't be pretty, won't be sweet, she's just sitting there on her feet. Sing it.
Oh, Lord, heaven knows we belong way down below. Oh, Lord, tell us so.
you can hear the crying.
This evening, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening and welcome to Wake Up USA, a UFO study, a Stardust radio production, now being broadcasted live in SRN 1690, Riverside, Iowa. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see everybody this evening. I hope everybody can hear us okay tonight. We're going to have Larry Warner show. He's out of the UK. Guys, be nice. It's 1 o'clock in the morning where he lives. He got up just to come talk to y'all. Peter Robbins is with us. Peter, where are you at tonight? Upstate New York, huh? I got quite a few friends up around that area. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to kind of skip the news tonight because we have both of them on the line with us, and we're just going to kind of start from here. Now, I know most of y'all are familiar with Peter Robbins. He's been on the show before, and I'm sure most of y'all have read the book, Left at Eastgate. So it's one of the things we will be talking about tonight because the gentleman, Larry Warren, was actually there, and it had quite a bit to do with the book. Huh, Larry?
Just a bit, my friend. Good to talk to the USA again.
Well, I'll tell you what,
what I'm going to do, Larry,
is I'm going to get you to tell the audience just a little bit about yourself, and then we'll start the interview from there, just to give them a feel about, you know, who you are and, you know, just kind of a basic feel. We don't want to give them too much detail too fast. They might overload on us.
Right on.
Okay, Larry, just give them a little bit short bio about yourself, and then we'll start from there.
Well, I'm kind of old now, and I live in England, Liverpool, England, but I'm born in New York City. I'm a Yankee. And fly the flag every 4th of July just to piss the neighbors off over here. And proud to be an American and co-authored Left at Eastgate with my fine friend that's on the radio there. And I was the whistleblower for the Rendlesham Forest, the Bentwaters incidents, however they call it. I was in the United States Air Force, honorably discharged, and I did what I believe was the right thing to say, these events happened, and I described what I saw, and they've been twisted and messed with for years to come, and I enjoy the fight, because it's worth it.
Oh, it is worth it, and I have to agree with
that's
you.
That's about it. And I'm good looking still.
Oh, see, that's what I tell you.
I got most of my teeth, you know. That's it.
Well, I'm all the time, just because I'm on the radio, don't think I'm not sexy now, you know. I'm still.
Hey, we try to convince ourselves.
They all know you look like George Clooney.
Well, that's what I tell them.
Peter, let me get you I know most everybody should be familiar with you, but just for the new listeners tonight, I'm going to get you to just tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we're going to get into the, I actually want to get into the Bentwater, but go ahead, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I am the co-author of Left at Eastgate, along with Larry Warren, and when Larry and I really started to work on the book, I guess I had 10 or 12 years in the field as an investigative writer, continue with that as a specialty. Tribute articles regularly where I can, and right now, one of the main reasons that Larry and I are back together is in December, an updated and revised edition of Left at Eastgate came out in the United Kingdom and all over the United States, and it's available from Cosimo Books, available at any book-related website, or can be ordered from your local bookstore, and we're still very proud of the hard work we put into it and the results that that book got.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, y'all will find links to it both on all of our websites, both on the Stardust Radio website and the Oddcar One website. It's also listed there, so you can just click right there, and it'll take you right where you need to be. You know, Larry, they always hand me a stack of research anytime we have a guest on the show. And I was reading through it, and before I get into the Bentwater case, I had read that you had had a childhood experience, and I was kind of interested in it, if you don't mind talking about it.
No, I wrote about it as well, and I've had things happen, and, you know, back in the 60s, this wasn't, I'm not from a family where the UFO thing was kind of pre- prevalent or there was interest. It was me, you know, and I think it just came from some strange events I had in my childhood, and they were very strange. So Ben Waters obviously wasn't the first thing I had. I mean, were they UFO related? Well, I had, there were some very strange things, and maybe more than my share, and that might short circuit a few folks, but you know, that's their problem, really. I live with it. And do I feel like a victim and this or that, or the abduction thing? I can't say I've ever experienced that, but I definitely have very strong memories of things that I wouldn't have been exposed to as a young kid through any media or through family or any of that kind of thing. And I think in New York City, where we have theater, four TV channels back then, and it just wasn't the thing. So I had memories of things going on, and some things in broad daylight that were, that stay with me. I mean, certainly, I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's something that's real. It must be if it impacts you this long. That's my opinion. To go into detail, I had numerous things since I was a kid, really. Very strange things. I don't think it's unique to me. I just think, you know, I'm more vocal about it. And then, of course, the Rendlesham thing happened, and I went through it, and I think, and I wasn't the only one with previous experiences, the witnesses involved, and even though it's, you know, 25 years ago, it was, I don't know, I think I was more predisposed to talk about it. It just was, it just triggered this necessity to say, wait a minute, here it is, and full color, you know, the cover-up does exist, it is real, I went through it, it wasn't lighthouses and rabbits tracings on the ground and all the nonsense they still dig up in England where I live, and, you know, all the it's boring, really, the nonsense that comes up with it, because it's so real, this subject. Anyone's experienced it knows it's real, they know there's something to it. You get in probably some trouble when you try to say what it is, because I don't know what it is, but it's real, and it's I've had experiences, and I've been blessed or cursed to have them since I was young, and so far so good. It's been quiet for the last few years. I don't know.
You know, Larry, after reading those notes, because I noticed that you had some family members with you, I'm not going to say who on air, but that's entirely to you, but at present, at least one of them, and it got me to thinking about something. So I did a little homework on some of the people who were present at Bentwater. And I think it's interesting that more than likely, three or four of y'all were probably contactees, or at least abductees. Maybe not contactees because you probably wasn't self-aware, but at least abductees. What I found interesting about it, and this is about the ratio for abductees, one out of every four or five of them, all of a sudden, after an experience, have this need, and I mean, maybe need's not the right word, maybe it's compulsion, but they have to talk about it. They have to.
I can remember. It's interesting. I know one in particular is that was Adrian Bastinza that had previous experiences, and I knew that for, you know, directly from him, even in those days, when we started to talk about the events in the aftermath of them. And there was, again, a very few people that literally went through them were talking all this stuff about rumor mills and everyone picking up stories on the base is an absolute myth. It was a couple days of, what the heck happened? Bump, gone. It was done. Unless you went through it. And then it was some quiet meetings that came about in maybe March of 81, where, you know, we talked about different experiences. It was like a floodgates open. And, you know, I'm with you on that one. I know one in particular. I wouldn't be surprised with others. I mean, there was an awful lot of guys that were involved in this in one way or another. There's a lot of strange stuff on that base and around that area. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just reading about, you know, you had made mention of underground facilities, and I know quite a few, post-World War II, quite a few American and British facilities were supposed to be adding large underground facilities. Now, I've seen a couple of myself when I was in the service.
Sure.
People say, oh, we can't build those. I'm like, yeah, whatever, people. We got, and like the one in Tennessee isn't even classified, and this thing's, what, 2 miles across, a half mile deep?
Right. Well, Peter came up with a lot, you know, he is the researcher with our book. He kind of tracked down a lot of guys and talked to people that were actually engineers that dealt with the facilities. And again, I was the first person to ever really talk about that. I was the first person to say that there were nuclear weapons on the bases at the time, thus constituting extreme defense significance to whatever happened, whether we're hallucinating or the events, as we say, happen, to quote Peter Hill Norton, Admiral of the Fleet of Great Britain. God rest his soul. And it turns out there are facilities down there. It turns out we had the largest backline in nuclear weapons. It turns out we were meddled with by the intelligence community. All these things that 20 years ago people, you know, it sounded like it was pre-X-Files, so it just sounded like complete lunacy. But I guess with the book, what throws people as they read it is the what we were led to think happened in this underground facility. I still have a conscious memory of probably 20 minutes of it. But, of course, I explored that with Bud Hopkins, and he doesn't lead people in all this crap either. He literally, I was hypnotized, and I didn't believe he could be. Peter was present. I was many years ago now, but I didn't want to remember it. I didn't, the session. And it came out to be a very terrestrial thing where I think they meddled with this a great deal. So if you were to talk about what really happened and then talk about, well, hey, even more happened, you're going to, it just would have been put in a nut house back then. But, you know, thanks to Bud, really. I mean, I read the transcripts of that. I have that session where I kind of revisited the underground end of it. And it isn't lunacy. I mean, it all makes sense to me at that point, other than, you know, are they alien presence underground? Probably. Are they, you know, who knows? But is it interacting with our government? I don't know. I don't know. But I think it was more CIA and NSA and stuff and narcotic, hypnotic meddling. And I was the first to say it. Now they're all coming out talking about their experiences with the same tactics. The other witnesses.
Other experiences, yeah. They, but that's, you know, that's something we always knew was going on, just nobody wanted to talk about it. You know, you can't honestly think our government was letting E.T. abduct people without at least checking to see every once in a while what was going on. I did find that interesting. You know, that's weird, too, because I just met Bud just recently at the Laughlin Conference, where Peter was at. And,
Right, I've known Bud for, you know, a good 20 years, and Peter a lot longer, and he's a great guy, and he, you know, he's gotten his stick and all that through the years, like anyone that kind of stands up for, you know, what you believe in this world. And but I have a lot of respect, and I think I wouldn't have let. I got around this guy years ago when I first came out. You're kind of like a circus monkey, and they had me. You got to be regressed, and I've read this book by Georgina Brunei, and I have to tell you, there's a lot of things in there that just aren't accurate, but. I was hypnotized. Someone had a hypnotized me, but the people involved in it had paid him. They said, "You got to be hypnotized." And I could hear the dog barking. I'm like, "What am I supposed to remember? What, how does this work?" And it didn't work. And I was very skeptical on the whole procedure. And I knew what Bud did. And I had talked to Bud for many years since the early '80s, and knew Bud. And then I decided to explore this very uncomfortable thing. So I'll tell you, it did work because I trusted the guy. And what came out was not what I expected. It was anything but. I was quite surprised with it. So I have the highest respect for the guy in the world. I think he's a hero. There must be statues built of Bud one day. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, a great guy. And his heart's in it. And I'd like to see any of these other monkeys out there that fling the mud, put as much effort into their beliefs and taking care of people like this cat does, because they don't. It's easier to just fling the mud, isn't it? And in this country, I live in England, and it's the worst for it. If someone's upset with that, fine, but it's a tabloid country, and it's a shame. It's a shame, you know. Any story on the subject with UFOs or on the Rendlesham case, which is right in their own backyard. They've got to stick a picture of E.T. and refer to a lighthouse theory some guy made years ago. And they still do it. I mean, we're a quarter century away from all that. And they just love doing that. So it's a sad world in those regards. I'm getting older with it, and you kind of accept it. And
We had Nick Pope on last week and Paula Harris, and we actually talked about Lindblom for a while on the show because we knew y'all were coming on this week.
Oh, right. How did that go?
Nick still works for the MOD, so when you ask him questions, sometimes he's kind of like, I'm an investigative reporter and an abduction investigator, so one of the things, while I ask him, I say, I know you're not going to be able to answer this, Nick, because you still work for the MOD, but can you at least give us some reference material?
Well, Nick's a great guy. I like Nick, and as a person, I've known him a long time, Pete does, and he's a personality, and he has a very heavy position with the MOD here, Ministry of Defense, and I've never fully understood his role in all this, and it escapes me in some ways, but I think he believes the subject's valid. I disagree with his views that there was no cover-up on the British end of it, because there was, and But he can't say otherwise. I'm not sure he knows otherwise. He wasn't even with the Ministry of Defense when this happened. So I don't think he can go further than what he does. He's a personality, and he's quite entertaining guy. He's fun to hang out with.
Well, he definitely thinks there was something going on, Rendlesham. He's just not sure.
Oh, yeah. No, he's not wrong. He's not wrong. But, for the fellas that went through it, you listen to the theories. A lot of us have different views. I've talked to witnesses that have never come out publicly to this day. And we're all affected by this in one way or another day to day forever. I get some resentment because I kind of pointed the arrows at, this guy was involved too, so the attention comes in their way. You got Charles Holt, who has a pension, who's like a tennis ball. He's back on one side, he's on the other side. It depends what show you catch him in. And that's his psychology, that's his position in the military, formal position. I can understand that. It gets a little boring, though. I'd like to see people just get a little more nerve and stand up. They probably feel better about themselves, too. I don't lose sleep at night over the thing at all, over anything we've written in our book, anything we've claimed, anything we've said. We've never, we wrote a nonfiction book, Left at Eastgate. We took 9.5 years, a marriage on my part down the drain, a lot of things in Peter's life, and we did it. We accomplished it. We're very proud that we did it. And we've never had a cease and desist letter or been sued for putting someone in a position they were not in or describing a scenario that did not happen. We're quite proud of that. That must say something.
I was talking with a bunch of the ICAR members just recently, and I know a lot of them have read the book, because we had gotten into quite a heated little discussion about y'all the other night. And
Who was this you were talking to, pal?
Huh? What was that?
It's
a group. It's
a bunch of folks, right on.
I'm for the International Community for Alien Research, and
I got you. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I was speaking with them the other night, and the thing about it was, it was just involved in this conversation, and it was very interesting to see how it goes because there's a very split reaction to Bentwater. A lot of people automatically just say, okay, yeah, it was ET, no ifs, ands, or buts. That it was military, no ifs, ands, or buts.
The following is a special alert for all former U.S. military personnel and their families.
Actually
the following
that,
is a special alert.
That military and special thing, because military had to be aware something was going on. I mean, I can't see how they weren't, there's something about that always has bothered me. When I was reading about when you were taken to that underground facility.
Right.
And it got me to thinking about a couple things because, I've heard that in so many scenarios. By the way, in case you didn't know, ICAR has investigated over 7,000 abduction cases. There's nobody...
Good for you. Yeah, excellent. Because I know it's real. It's funny the positions people take with the event, and if they... I've always said the best way now at this point, because we're all, years are going by and we're... the youngest guys involved are in their mid-40s, really, at this point, and the oldest are in their mid-60s. So, time steps on, but theories are one thing. But, I think if there could ever be a gathering at some point where the people that actually lived this thing sat down, it would probably dust a few people. It really would. And everyone has opinions, but they're not always informed on the whole thing. I'm not saying that I know everything about it. I certainly don't. But I know what I experienced. I wrote about it. People would accept and reject it. That's their right. It's not a mission with me anymore. It's kind of like I've done it, and I want my son to be proud of me, his generation. This will all be viewed much different than it is now. But it's shameful in the States that this event, and I've been kicking its butt for years, since the early 80s, to get this, the attention, the case the attention it deserves, because it had a human toll. I don't care where this stuff came from. That's the government's problem. I care about the people it affected. We have people from the Bible Belt that thought it was the devil. We got a suicide, at least, after the fact. So it's not UFO stories. And unfortunately, in this field, it's all too often entertainment, I think, at conferences for people, and you start feeling like the dancing monkey with the organ grinder. And I felt that way many years ago. Nowadays, you do reach people, hopefully, and just get people to think. But, you know, opinions are one thing. Talk to the people that lived it, and inform yourself. Read everything you can, accept and reject, and come to an intelligence conclusion. But I can assure you what it was. It was lighthouses, a military experiment, this and that. Someone else was there. It's just that simple. And the evidence actually would win in any court of law. That's a point that's never been disputed that Peter and I have made for years.
Yeah, and
we sound so smug and arrogant, but we do know it. We do know it.
It's,
what was that, Peter?
Both Larry and I are very open-minded on the nature of what happened there, and if somebody could actually establish for us with real evidences in a uncontested kind of way that it was something other than we think it was, I don't think either one of us would lose any sleep over it. Neither of us have ever been married to an agenda here. However, for those in your audience who take the point of view that this was probably some psyops operation and the men involved on the third night, like Larry, were subjected to some kind of mind alteration and, you know, holograms and all kinds of high-tech hardware, I'd like them to consider the following, and this is just kind of a random sample here. The exact site in the farmer's field called Cape of Green, where the machine made its appearance on the third night, which Larry describes in unforgettable terms in our book, there is a discoloration in the soil, and I saw at the moment Larry pointed to it the first time he had returned to it and the first time I was there. This is more than 8 years after the incident. My first reaction was not, oh my God, look, it's a trace case. You can see the difference in the soil. My first reaction was, interesting coincidence, but this is farm country. It could have been a load of nitrate fertilizer that wasn't properly spread. It could actually be a play of light, and I'm seeing an illusion. Maybe lightning hit there 2 years ago. But the more we looked at it, we really saw that there was a difference. And I took samples and to cut to the chase over the next few years, and that saw that you could see the impression in the soil. A year and a half later, I went back. We're now almost 10 years after the fact. I could see it very clearly in the color of the grass. The area where this thing had sat was kind of an oval, and it was bright green, and it was surrounded by grass that was all already yellow and going to hay. Well, when the laboratory did the analysis, and a highly regarded, extremely respected environmental research laboratory in Wareham, Massachusetts, conducted these tests appropriately, we found out several things, among which was the concentration of tiny little metallic particles in the affected area was more than four times that of the surrounding areas, suggesting to our analyst that whatever sat there had subjected the surrounding area to a very, very powerful electromagnetic effect. Number two, when they did seed germination tests in the affected soil samples I had brought back and the control samples from around the field, and I sent back pounds of soil for investigation, seeds would germinate in the affected soil, but they would always take longer, and they were mutated.
The pH was blown from the soil. The regular farm soil became mud when you added some water. The affected soil, even though this was years after the fact, clumped up, either sank to the bottom or floated like dust on the top. And perhaps most intriguing of all was being so close to the water. We were only about 6 miles from the coast here. You would expect a certain amount of sand content in farm soil, and of course it was just what it was supposed to be, except that in the affected sample, the dispassionate laboratory term was that, the sand is in an interim form of glass. It had melted. They were not able to reproduce these results in their laboratory. The only reason I bring this up here is because while I respect the point of view, and it's true, men's minds were messed around with, there's no question about it. All kinds of special FX may have been used. There was definitely a desire to suggest certain things to affect their thinking on what they had really seen. But again, for anybody who feels this was simply a matter of holograms and, you know, guys who had been somehow mind-altered, this does not melt sand. It does not mutate plants. It does not change the color of soil. And this was multiply witnessed. So as we move on, again, we are open to it, but my feeling is, yeah, this was other intelligences from other places there for whatever reasons they come here. And the Air Force and the NSA was treating it as a tremendous potential security problem, and God knows, against the backdrop of what was going on in Poland at the time, we were very close to conflict as far as their pro-democracy movement being on the edge of smash by the Soviets. And at the same time, there was, as Larry mentioned, a very, very serious nuclear treaty violation at the time, and the lion's share of that ordnance was right under this Twin Base complex.
But, you know, that in itself is just intrigues the hell out of me, because, what, I mean, that's a major major treaty violation. That's one of those
major
part of war. And I don't know, sometimes I wonder what's going on with the U.S. and its allies, and, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing, Joe, is that until now,
nothing good if you live in Europe.
Until Larry first talked about that violation and the fact that he had had, among other things in his basic training with the Air Force, specialty training in working around nuclear ordnance. He was posted on a base that supposedly was nuclear-free, but it was loaded with armament, and that ultimately it was none other than the former chief of staff of the Ministry of Defense, the late Lord Peter Hill Norton, who chased this down and authenticated it. And that's a man who was, in his time, the chief of staff of the Ministry of Defense, the full equivalent of, say, Colin Powell.
Well, he was the head of NATO on top of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, it was, you know, the nuclear thing was, I mean, when I first went to Bentwaters, I Rick Bernalino was another security police. And we were in the men's room at McGuire Air Force Base, and I said, so we got nukes over there or what? And I'll tell you what, the whole room went silent, this men's room. And I was young and stupid, but when we got over there, I mean, you remember, if you're old enough, the they remember it here in England, definitely, was Greenham Common. You had the ban the bomb movement and the whole bit, and the women would handcuff themselves to the fence at Greenham Common, which was a base southern England, and that's where we allegedly had housed nuclear ordnance. And they camped out there. They were lunatics, frankly. It's a great honorable thing, but these were insane people, frankly, in my opinion, for years. And what must really upset them now when they hear that that was a diversion, the actual storage area for the tactical nuclear weapons, which are 1 megaton blast radius, 350,000 kilotons, we kept, which I knew because of my clearance. I have no problem saying it because I only threw that card on the table once they kept saying these events were of no defense significance, and I had my passport suspended by my own government for speaking about sensitive defense issues in a public forum on foreign soil. So they kind of...
Wait, Larry, I got to be right there because we got to go to break.
ladies and gentlemen.
And Mills.
Wake Up USA, a UFO study, a Stardust radio production, now being broadcasted live in SRN 1690, Riverside, Iowa. I'm your host, Joe Montalvo. I'm sitting and speaking with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins, and as soon as we return, we'll start taking some questions, so please stay tuned.
The following is a special alert for all former U.S. military personnel and their families. Our veterans are facing dramatic increases in health care costs and service reduction. Both the DOD and DVA are attempting to redefine and reduce benefits and services. Retired military families are targeted for huge cost increases in TRICARE coverage. VA services and facilities across the country are facing severe cutbacks, even closure. Our veterans are under attack. On April 25th, Operation Firing for Effect will hold a rally on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol. If you oppose balancing the federal budget on the backs of our veterans, come and stand with us. Visit VetMarch2006.net.
This internet station sounds great on your computer, but wouldn't it be even better if you could take it with you wherever you go? Now you can. This station is proud to be affiliated with the Mobile Broadcast Network, brought to you exclusively by XS Voice. They make it possible for you to hear your favorite internet station anytime, anywhere, on your cell phone. To get connected, go to www.mynbn.com and listen to internet radio on the go.
Have you always wanted to know the truth about things like UFOs, underground bases, Area 51, the Great Pyramid at Giza, and the Roswell incident of 1947? If so, look no further than Dennis Ballfaser's cutting-edge research. There's no woo-woo factor here, folks, just the fact that he researched them. Dennis's lectures are available on video and audio cassette. For more information and free access to Dennis's research, visit his website, www.truthseekeratroswell.com. That's truthseekeratroswell.com. The truth is here.
Climate change could affect our way of life. Reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and help control climate change. Visit www.vcr-mvr.ca. Brought to you by the Voluntary Challenge and Registry, Climate Change Central, and this radio station.
SRN 1690 AM, Riverside, Iowa, and around the world on the Stardust Radio Network. www.stardustradio.com.
You're listening to the Stardust Radio Network, where talent and technology meet.
Good evening, and welcome back to Wake Up USA, a UFO study, a Stardust Radio production. Now being broadcasted live on SRN 1690, Riverside, Iowa. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Y'all know I'm sitting and speaking with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. Larry, you know, I'm going to get them to tell you a little bit about your experience, and you've already got a bunch of questions stacked up. Well, let me ask you this, since we got you on tonight, We'll do it your way. Would you rather take the questions first and then come back to the Bentwater case, or do the Bentwater case and then take the questions?
It's your show, pal. Whatever you want to do.
I just want you to be comfortable because, we're just here. We're just exchanging information while all kind of laid back, and we enjoy ourselves. We like doing the show. And one of the things you're going to find out is most of our listening audience that are going to probably be asking you questions are fellow ufologists.
Really?
More likely they've done their homework.
Hey, listen, I'm with you. Whatever you want to do, man. I'm just sitting here in Liverpool, hearing the wind blowing garbage cans around. I'm up for anything.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, before we open it up for questions, I've read a couple of things about Bentwater, which I found interesting, and then there was a particular description you were given in the craft. In your own words, because I really want to hear in your own words, basically the events approaching, leading up to seeing this craft and then what it looked like. Because I'm just curious, when I read it, that just kept sticking in the back of my head, and I guess when you say it, maybe that'll clear it up for me.
Okay, all right. That night, in particular on the third night, I was D-Flight security, and that's been established long ago. And I was taken off a post at the end of Bentwater's runway, which is manned during alert condition. And we were under an alert condition during that period for whatever reason. I've proven that with photographs, et cetera, whatever. We were under an alert. It wasn't just a fluke. And I didn't know about the previous two nights of activity. I remember these were three nights of events. It's taken 25 years for people to kind of figure out it was three nights, not one or two or whatever. And on this third night, I was picked up by Lieutenant Bruce England, who was ex-Army, I think he was, and Sergeant Adrian Mastinzi was driving the pickup truck. It was an open truck. I deactivated my post. We had Motorola radios, M16 rifles, and I was told to get in the back of the vehicle. I got in this pickup truck with a few other fellas, one of which I trained with down in Texas. We took off for the motor pool, got some light alls. There was some problems with the lighting equipment. I've seen it written in books. This was on Woodbridge. It was not. It was on Bentwaters at this time where this happened, because that's where our motor pool was. And people like rewriting history, but they weren't there. Took off to the main gate of Bentwaters, and there were other vehicles present, some law enforcement police cars, LE. The difference in the military at that time, the security police are now called force protection, but in those days it was law enforcement police, which are like your cops on the community, you know, on the base, and then there was us, which was more combatants, heavy arms, anti-terrorist trained, nuclear security, all that, and I was one of them. Secret clearance, the whole bag. So we took off toward RAF Woodbridge. Didn't know what was going on. Got to the end of the Woodbridge runway after about a 3.5 mile, 4 mile drive. I think Peter will agree that the trip seems to, between the bases, gets so small because we've been going back to a place I couldn't wait to get the heck out of so much over the last 20 plus years that it's silly now, but it's like home. And but I was very unfamiliar with the terrain at that point. I just had some schooling on Woodbridge. I had already been posted to my flight after 2 weeks of incoming training. Now, Charles Hald always says, there's no way I would have been involved in all this because I was still in training. Well, Eddie Kavanasak, who was involved, I knew him, he was a friend of mine. He was involved on the first night of events. I didn't know he even went through anything. That's how silent this thing was. Ed said on that, Eddie had gotten there, he was in the flight in Texas just after me, the police academy, and he had just been on the base and just finished by a day his incoming training. So how was he involved? So Mr. Hall, you know, talks a lot of beans a lot, God bless his soul. But at the end of the day, we got to the end of the Woodbridge flight line. There was a roadblock of sorts, very loose one, but law enforcement police car, some flares on the road, and there was a civilian car we pulled up next to. It was a white Ford Cortina. It's a very popular kind of car. I think the whole country drove them at that time in England, and there was a little girl asleep, and the law enforcement cops said there was unexploded ordnance. They felt, and that's what they were investigating, and they wouldn't belay her. We went through it, turned into Rendlesham Forest. We turned left after Eastgate. I've literally had these moron debunkers or whatever they are out there pick that apart, the title of the book. That's the best they could do. It's not actually left at Eastgate. You wouldn't be there. We were told, where are we going? Lieutenant England asked the road guard. He said, turn left after Eastgate. So, sue me. I put the book as left at Eastgate. Made sense to me. And we turned left into the forest on Commission Trail, Forestry Commission, and went about a quarter mile, got to a parking area, circular area, got out, and we were disarmed. There was an armory vehicle with racks, gun racks on the back. We couldn't have active weapons off the base, though there were some personnel on previous nights that did have sidearms. But they didn't know what they were encountering either. At this point, senior people on that base did know there was something really wrong, and these objects had returned, clearly. I didn't know this still. I thought we were fighting in a training exercise, which would happen in Rendlesham Forest during the day. There was something about fires. We thought it was a fire exit. We just didn't know. We were kind of greenhorns. And we had to maintain radio silence. We broke up into groups of people. There were numerous people out in that forest. There were flashlights going through all the trees. You could see it. And there was a song by the police at that time. It was very popular. It was Walking on the Moon. And I think of that song. Whenever I think of that song, I think of not the event itself, but going through the forest to it. It just had that vibe, man. It just brings you right to that time. So we're walking along, and we would stop, we would go. We kept hearing October number one, and over the open channels, there were four channels of security police band, and they were trying to hoping that he was, because I saw him. And so we moved forward through the trees for quite a bit, because we didn't follow the trails that maybe Peter would be familiar with now, because I don't think anyone's too familiar with the lay of the forest, really, at that point. We wouldn't have had a need to be. Off to my left, there was a point about 50 yards or so with red tape or some kind of a string that was bright orange, Big Jim flashlights, if you remember them, on the ground. And I do believe this is Charles Holt's site where they were seeing, where they were reporting an earlier site with indentations and markings, which would not have been the first night's incident, because they wouldn't have investigated that in the middle of the night, two nights later. It just escapes logic. So something had happened there. And I do believe, personally, that's where Holt was. I never physically saw Holt out there. I know he was, because it's the same night.
Or did he see you?
Sorry?
Andrew, it makes sense.
And, of course, he didn't see you either.
Well, it's not important, because there was so many people out there, but he wasn't the senior man on site at all. I know I was with Robert Ball. I remember he was my flight chief. I know the people I was with. Charles Holt I knew, but I didn't know he was there. But it makes sense to me. This is the site where they start reporting the beginning of our incident on Capel Green. And it is so obscured from his point of view from then on that God knows maybe one day he'll say what he knows, because he knows more than what he says. But beyond him, I can only deal with me. And I walked to, there was a slight rise in the giant oak tree. It was lit up. I could see in the distance a farmer's house. And in the middle of this field, a grass field, there was no snow on the ground. It was cold to probably the southern guys, but being from upstate New York, growing up there, it was pretty mild. It was in the 30s. And so you get a different perspective on how the weather was. To me, it wasn't that bad when we have 17 below zero half the time in the winter. So we moved up. I get on the hill. There was a guy I knew that was having a problem near a tree, and he was being spoken to by the flight chief. We moved beyond that. There was a fence that had been, there was a board put on it, I believe, that we could step over, and they had knocked the original barbed wire fence down, which Peter is at. It's still there, what we literally knocked down, and walked over that. And in the field was a circular object. It was about 50 feet in diameter, roughly 30 to 50. It was part of the ground. It was translucent. It was greenish yellow. You could see the ground through it. So you wouldn't, I don't know what I thought. I mean, you wouldn't have think flying saucer, because it wasn't, it was just the fog, but it had definition to it. And off to the left of where I'm looking is a farmer's house. The upper light was on. There was a dog barking. Beyond that, just south of that, was the slight, and I mean the slightest of maybe flash from the Orford Lighthouse, because the night had, there were some clouds and things, but it was somewhat clear too. And so this little kind of occasional blink, which was just an illumination of cloud, it wasn't even the beam. You couldn't see the beam of that lighthouse. It's a myth. It had been there 100 freaking years, and no one ever reported UFOs doing this before and mistaking this darn lighthouse. So absolutely the most insulting thing I've ever heard in my life, and most people are too chicken to ever say that to my face or any of the witnesses. And so that was doing its thing, as it had done for 100 years, I guess, because there was a little something, a little occasional brush of something on the clouds. But the issue was south of that, further down, out toward the North Sea, south of the Orford Key, was a red light that appeared. It looked like taillights on aircraft very quickly. It did an arc in over the field so quick, as soon as we saw it, like a loop, a U-shape, stopped over this thing, this mist that had circular definition. It was amber color. It was the size of a basketball, approximately about 30 feet high, 20 feet, 30 feet in the air. And it dispersed. This happened so quick. But in this field at the same time, and I've said this for years, and it has been backed up by Captain Mike Verano, who flew this film or brought the film to an aircraft with the guy that says he was never there, Gordon Williams, and didn't know a thing, but he knew about the film for some reason and drove it to the aircraft, an F-16, which a new aircraft then, and it went off to 8th Air Force. That was the next day. So that's on CNN 20 years ago. It's old news now. It happened. That film exists. But there were cameras in that field. There was a handheld shoulder-mounted camera, which could have been base public affairs, I don't know, or some agency, and then there was a stationary one on a tripod, and there were still photographs being taken. Those were the only flashes, really, that you'd notice, not any lighthouse or anything. They were photographing this, and this thing dispersed in color, and it was very hard to describe, many years have passed, but there was extremely bright shards of light, lines of light that would fall down on this in this area, and something happened, and now there was this structured distorting thing in its place, and it was triangular in shape, concave at points with extensions on it. No windows, landing gear, I couldn't see anything like that, nothing landed. A spaceship, I've seen that quote in other people's books. I've never said a spaceship. I don't know where the hell it comes from. I just know it wasn't from Detroit, built there. And there were boxes, and it was very, very strange. And the more you looked at it, it would change on you. And it was very bright and white and dirty colored and with blue base and a kind of this red thing near the top. You have to understand movement at this point. You don't have to understand because there's no way you ever would hearing this, but without seeing it, and then you still don't. But movement, as soon as you got near this area before this happened, was at half speed. Your arms felt heavier. You felt, it's funny now thinking, because I can remember that feeling. You did feel a bit out of, half a step out of your own self, not quite in control of your motor functions, maybe. And whatever, people say, oh, that could have been the result of shock. Well, I wasn't in shock here because I know what was about to happen. It was a very strange feeling that I still remember. And this object was there. It was dead silent in that forest. I believe on Charles Holt's tape, when they see a small red light, which came in years after I described this, that's the beginning of our event. They're describing it from almost 200 yards away in the forest through the pine trees. I'm certain he's witnessed this part of it. Other people arrived on site. One was Gordon Williams. He was a wing commander. I know he was because he was his bodyguard when he changed, became a general and left the base. He gave us the incoming briefing when we got to the base. As a base commander, a wing commander, he would have needed to be involved in these events, not let someone else handle it, for God's sake. I mean, we're alleging, his officers are alleging there were unidentified objects near a nuclear base. You're not going to say, well, heck, I'm just going to enjoy the Christmas season and drink my, Remy Martin and kick back. I mean, you're going to get out there and check it out. So I find that argument pretty embarrassing, and I think most thinking people would, but that's his conscience. God bless him. He was there, and he was present and saw this object, three things, this light came away from it. We went into a covered wagon scenario where you isolate a nuclear device. I think that's all they could really do. People were dispersed. I have to tell you, some people ran away into the woods. The camera people were filming. Sergeant Bastinza said to me, he said, just like what happened to me in Alaska. He says later it was California. Sorry. I don't know about that, but I can remember that very clearly. And they had Geiger counter things going on, and I didn't know what they were then. And there was this object that broke away from it, the right side of the object from where I was standing. And within this bright light, it split into three, whether people like it or not. And inside, these individual bluish gold lights were these ethereal-looking, ghosty, kind of your classic big-eyed little fellas there. But not like the movies do. I mean, this was almost, it wasn't a projection. It was definitely, these were acting independent of each other. And it was completely, bad use of vanity here, but it was completely bleeped up, I mean, and it still is. And I stand by what I saw. Other people have verified now that this happened. It was very disturbing to a lot of people because, I mean, you are facing something totally conscious that isn't supposed to be, you know, at the end of the day. And you're facing this with numerous individuals, just like Holt's memorandum states. I have never forgotten it. I would, you could put a gun to my head and I wouldn't deny it. And it's just the way it went down. What it was, I don't know. But was it alive? Absolutely. And it was someone else. It was not human. It was no way was it human. No way was it an experiment. This was before the meddling took place. The meddling had nothing to do with these events. The meddling had to do with confusing the issues afterward. You know, we were highly trained observers. These were unlike, this was unlike probably many of these guys had ever experienced. There was nothing like it. And this is all filmed. I've never wavered from this stuff. I mean, I've heard all this, oh, he changes his story and all this. Show me where. I've seen researchers and other writers change my story, but I wrote a book. That's it. That's the story.
That's the best.
And this thing went down, and other people have verified it. End of. Done. You work on your acceptance of it. I'm not saying you personally, but the listeners, the debunkers, the average human being, and then figure out where we're going in the world, because I've been dealing with it for 25 years. Welcome aboard. But it happened. And there's guys that suffered with this. And it's not so much because the stuff was there, because we were pulled away very quick. I think my main point is that there's some, I do believe there was some kind of protocol to deal with this. And in the military, this kind of a scenario, and I think it was used that night just by observation. We were pulled away, went back to the base, had guys on the day flight making fun of us, went back to my room. First thing I wanted to do that day was call my mother. And my mother is alive and well, and would tell you to this day, he called me. I was with Greg Batram, who lives in St. Louis, Missouri. God bless him. I hope he's well. And who went through these events, too, saw me going out there. He was leaving as we were going in. And I called her up, and I said, you won't believe what happened to us last night.
She had a witness with her.
Huh?
And she had a witness with her.
Oh, yeah, a friend of hers that lives in Kentucky now. But, I mean, they're older ladies now, but, I mean, it went down. I mean, my family isn't going to lie for me. And I said to my mother, look, a UFO landed near the base. We saw it. And I wasn't there anymore. And immediately I had been, we have a thing called communicate ComSec, and this is the British phone system is kind of antiquated at that time. And I was tracked doing this, all calls in and out of the base, very naive on my part. Went to eat breakfast. I sat near Sergeant Peniston, who was, as I know now, was off duty because of his event two nights previous. Steve Longero, a guy from Milpitas, California. These are real names, real people, real towns. Seek them out. And started talking to me and said, what the hell did we go through? And Sergeant Peniston said, Warren, shut the F up. And he confirms that. And it just got worse from there, my friend. And the event with the spooks started later that evening. And I was with Sergeant Bestenza when we were taken to this car. We were hit with aerosols. We went through a debriefing, and it was in Malcolm Ziegler's office. He has verified that. We were shown a film. That's been verified. I mean, what more do people want other than they get little snippets here and there, and you get certain researchers that specialize in Roswell and whatever the heck they do, and then attack everyone else that's ever done the real work on it and throw their stones, and they get mad because they're not credited in your book. I've never met such morons in my life through this work, but I've met some of the greatest people I ever know, and I stand by what I say, and I think most of it has been verified, and it's helped me deal with, you know, kind of accept certain things. I mean, I didn't like, yay, flying saucers and aliens. I don't know what this was. But it definitely caused hell on earth with the military and British civilians and the British government. There's no question. And I'm sure Mr. Carter's government in transition to Ronald Reagan's. I'll shut up now.
Oh, no, no, you wait now, Larry. You're doing fine, man. I understand being passionate about this. I've been doing this much.
Well, I'm beyond passionate, my brother. You know, the thing is, it's, and Peter knows, I mean, I don't want, you know, I'm a pretty plain-spoken guy, but, you know, the best audience I think we ever had with anything, or when you're talking to people about this, or people who have read our book, or people outside the UFO field, because they're not tainted by it or anything, and they're not wigged out or whatever. You have to live through this stuff. I mean, just have to live through it. And then you have to see that things you think, you're raised one way to think things are a certain way, and they're not, because a guy was allowed to commit suicide who tried to go AWOL. This is the government he's serving allowed him to do it. Yeah, I was in the military because I love my country. I still do. I believe in it. I believe in our right to stand up and protest. I live in a country where freedom of speech is not a right, okay? It is not an open-booked right. But, you know, I'm not going to get into the politics of things, but anyone who wants to knock it, live abroad for a while and see how well-liked Yankees are nowadays. It's not a nice time. But I love my country. I just think it can be better with truth, and I think this is one subject that can change a lot of things. Might scare a lot of the radicals and lunatics out in the world, but you know, maybe we'd build an island and they would all make a big car bomb and get rid of themselves. I'd be very happy with that. But I'll shut up again. I'm going to have Al-Qaeda after me or something.
Hey, look, yeah, you ever in the UK, they might blow you up over the ass. That's what they're doing. They blow up a bus station, we take a country. I'm not sure how that works, but still.
Yeah, I get angry, you know, with the whole thing, because I love veterans. I'm a veteran, and I just don't like people crapping from a great height on their head. They're over there doing a job, and, you know, we were doing a job, and we went through a thing that, by no means it compares to being in combat or warfare or anything like that, but it was a whole different level of weirdness and craziness. And you have unchecked intelligence community sources that have unappropriated budgets from Congress. They don't even talk to Congress, and they're operating the show. I think this is private industry doing half this stuff. We had aircraft landing on that base to investigate this stuff that even the base commanders couldn't go near or approach and ask why they were there. This isn't me saying it. These are coming from Charles Holt and all the witnesses. It's fantastic. The truth of this thing, the best documentary, the best kind of forum with Rendlesham or Bentwaters is yet to come. I've always said the story will take me out of this thing, and it will still be there. It will never go away. This is the one. This is the one you take to court and win.
Well, Joe has had a chance to really read the book, and he certainly appreciates our situation, your situation. The fact of the matter is that, you know, everything that Larry is saying, I spent almost 10 years of my life investigating, corroborating, backing up, and we're stuck with it, whether we like it or not.
We don't like it. We don't like it at all.
It's no, bad. Not a lot.
It's frustrating.
It is true.
I mean, I have taxi drivers here. In my job, I work. I'm a regular working stiff like anyone else. And I have people, you know, that recognize you from these, you know, when you're occasionally on a TV thing or the books or whatever. Are you this guy? And they go, well, they see the job I'm in. They go, well, that's proof you were never in it for the money. So, and they're like, well, man, you know, that book did, you know, made me really think and all. And I guess that's all it's about, you know. Goodwill. You know, people thinking of the bigger picture.
I try to play.
I'm no great sage or anything, for God's sake. Ask Peter. Approve it.
But you can't make any money in ufology. It's not. That, I try to explain that to people. People tell me all the time, well, you're in this for money. I said, no, it costs me money every year. So I'm not making any.
We weren't in it for money, Joe. We were in it for the women.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't.
That didn't work out too well either, so.
No, not really. No.
No. No. Well, but I think Peter would agree. I tell you, I've had people say, would you do two marriages down the toilet? I have a son that means more to me than, you know, I'm an older father. He's five, my Dennis, and I'll tell you what, this guy's going to look out world. But he's my pride and joy for sure, and changed my world. You know, Pete's Uncle Peter, for God's sake. And the thing is, I look at their generation, and, you know, what's he going to think of all this, you know? And I'd like him to take a different path, but I always, you know, I've had people say, you know, what do you think your kid would think of this well, you're known for UFOs. Do you think you get a stick in school and all? I said, I would think my son would be pretty damn proud of his old man and stand by his beliefs. And, you know, even as adverse as doing that on any issue, for that matter, can be. You know, it's just, it wasn't hard work to do it because it happened. It wasn't like I didn't need a good memory, because you don't need a good memory when you're telling the truth. As you put, now my perception could be weird on certain things and skewed, but that's the way it is. It's part of my life. It happened. I can't change it. It will always be my life to the end. And I just hope something good comes out of it. Like folks that do the shows you're doing, the people that call in, the people that listen to them, that keep an open mind and look and keep asking questions.
Well, let me go take a break.
That's all it's about, really, on a million issues, not just UFOs. It's whatever this phenomenon is.
Exactly.
I do believe it's the key to where we're going, whether good or bad.
Hey, I'm sorry, man. Yeah, we got to take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, I want everyone to please stay tuned to Wake Up USA, a UFO study, a Stardust Radio production, now being broadcasted live in SRN 1690, Riverside, Iowa. I'm your host, Joe Montalvo. I'm speaking with Larry Warren and Peter. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. My brain is going in. Anyway, we'll see y'all in a few minutes, so please stay tuned.
The following is a special alert for all former U.S. military personnel and their families. Our veterans are facing dramatic increases in health care costs and service reduction. Both the DOD and DVA are attempting to redefine and reduce benefits and services. Retired military families are targeted for huge cost increases in TRICARE coverage. VA services and facilities across the country are facing severe cutbacks, even closure. Our veterans are under attack. On April 25th, Operation Firing for Effect will hold a rally on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol. If you oppose balancing the federal budget on the back of our veterans, come and stand with us. Visit VetMarch2006.net.
This internet station sounds great on your computer, but wouldn't it be even better if you could take it with you wherever you go? Now you can. This station is proud to be affiliated with the Mobile Broadcast Network, brought to you exclusively by XS Voice. They make it possible for you to hear your favorite internet station anytime, anywhere, on your cell phone. To get connected, go to www.mynbn.com and listen to internet radio on the go.
Have you always wanted to know the truth about things like UFOs, underground bases, Area 51, the Great Pyramid at Giza, and the Roswell incident of 1947? If so, look no further than Dennis Ballfaser's cutting-edge research. There's no woo-woo factor here, folks, just the facts as he researched them. Dennis's lectures are available on video and audio cassette. For more information and free access to Dennis's research, visit his website, www.truthseekeratroswell.com. That's truthseekeratroswell.com. The truth is here.
Climate change could affect our way of life. Reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and help control climate change. Visit www.vcr-mvr.ca. Brought to you by the Voluntary Challenge and Registry, Climate Change Central, and this radio station.
I'm William Shatner, and this is Jimmy. Animals like Jimmy are often left behind by people fleeing hurricanes, fires, floods, and earthquakes. These abandoned animals cannot survive on their own. If you must evacuate your home, please never leave an animal behind. If you absolutely cannot take your animal with you, never leave him helplessly chained or caged. Many animals die because they cannot escape fires or rising waters. Animals need your help. Thank you.
Call PETA today, 757-622-PETA.
SRN.
1690 AM, Riverside, Iowa, and around the world on the Stardust Radio Network. www.stardustradio.com.
You're listening to the Stardust Radio Network, where talent and technology meet.
Good evening and welcome back to Wake Up USA, a UFO study, a Stardust Radio production. Now being broadcasted live on SRN 1690, Riverside, Iowa. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Joe Talent, sitting and speaking with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. Apparently I can speak again now, so I'm not sure what happened. We're going to go straight into some questions because I know I've been hogging up all Larry and Peter's time, so who we got up first? Let's see, we got EVAC747 up. So, EVAC, why don't you come up, give us your first name and location, and you're live and on air with Peter and Larry.
How you doing tonight? Name's Jim. I'm in New Jersey.
What I want to say was, my wife and I were in Florida, and I have a military background, Special Forces, 2 years in Vietnam, year in Korea, and I'd gone to Florida and joined the Florida Marine Police, and every once in a while, the Everglades Rangers would request a few bodies to patrol the Everglades. So three of us were in separate airboats, and we were patrolling, and I saw something out in the distance, didn't know what it is, and I called into control, and I said, does the Air Force have anything out in the Everglades in our patrol area tonight? And they came back, and they said, no, but it's on radar, and they are sending jets to investigate. Well, in the meantime, I moved in a little closer and contacted the other two patrol boats, and I asked them, I said, you guys do what I'm looking at 2 o'clock. And they came back, well, yes, we do. It looks like a Goodyear blimp. I said, gee, do you see the word Goodyear blimp anywhere? There's no gondola, no engines underneath of it, nothing. It's sitting about 100 feet above us. So I said, listen up. We have red and blue lights behind us, right behind our props. So why don't we just shut down and just watch this thing until the jets get here? So we shut down the engines because we've got these red and blue flashing lights behind our heads. We watched it for about 15 minutes. And then all of a sudden, all these lights come on out of nowhere. Reds, blues, greens, all kinds of things. But it looked like a blimp, but it wasn't. And when the Air Force jets arrived, this thing was gone in a heartbeat. Now, this is the first time I've ever discussed this with anyone. I never discussed it with my wife or anyone else. But when we got in off the patrol the next morning, the Air Force was waiting for us at control. They wanted to know exactly what we had witnessed. And then they told us, well, you can't talk about this. It's going to be under classification. So for all these years, I've never opened my mouth about it. This is the first time I've ever discussed it. I know Lady ZV, she knows me, and this is the first time I've even thought about discussing it. But whatever was out in those Everglades was
the
commercial.
Thanks for your service, too, my brother.
And it wasn't one of ours.
You're a hero.
Because
you know,
as soon as you get up there,
yourselves are starting to tell these things, and, boy, the people need to hear it, and just the fact you've done it is a big step. I thank you, really.
Yeah, and as shattering as this is in your life and any of the men that were with you when it happened, it is almost more shocking how often Larry and I have heard similarly compelling accounts from as righteous people as you with absolutely gilt-edged military background. It is going on, it's happening, and many of the witnesses are among the most credible people imaginable.
You know what? It is amazing. I'll tell you what, too, back when I'm thinking about this, you need to go to www.ICA01.com, file a report, let one of our investigators get in touch with you, talk it, we can get it all documented up. You know, this actually helps what Peter and Larry are talking about tonight. Any cases with the military where we have people involved with the military that we can check, it's a big plus, man. It just leads credence to more and more people that are coming forward. You know, which we need. We need more and more and more. Look, people, I know y'all can hear me out there. I know a lot of people from the military listen to this radio show because I do read my emails. And, guys, you know, I came forward. Larry came forward. A lot of people coming forward. You guys just came forward on national radio. Come on, guys. Pick up the phone, you know, come in. Come in one of the virtual chat rooms, but come in and tell us about it. You know, it's very strange when people come in on the show like that and tell accounts. It always kind of freaks me out a little bit, but I see.
That's a hero, man. And, you know, any listener to ex-military or anything, is they can check into the DisclosureProject.org from back in 2001, where 20 military, some base commanders, et cetera, former head of the FAA, division chief from Eastern USA, we stood up. I was there. I was a little mouse compared to the credentials on these people. And they went forward. And, of course, we did this at the NPC in Washington, D.C. We had major press from around the world. It was the best attended by press conference even with an acting president in there, like Reagan, there was more press. They didn't leave after 4 hours. There wasn't a dang thing on the news that night about it, as usual. And it was historic. I was honored to be part of it. But what these folks can find, if they're ex-military or current or law enforcement, is that there are law enforcement sites now for ex-law enforcement that can report these cases. There are military sites like Disclosure, where people are feeling free to come forward or at least share their accounts, be put in touch with other witnesses that went through it with them. And they're not alone. And that fellow Jim, that's he's a veteran, of course. He's a hero anyway, but he's even more one. Thanks.
Well, I'm always grateful when people are coming forward. It's a big deal. Greg, who's been patiently waiting, so do you get your hand up? Why don't you come up, give us your first name and location, and you're live on the air with Larry and Peter.
Thank you, Joe. This is directed towards, I better tell who I am first. This is Dee. I'm the Southwest Regional Director for ICAR. This question is combined for Larry and Peter. Most everybody is familiar with the case that happened in December of 1980. But what I'd like to hear a little more about is the sightings that both of you had while on your first trip together back to the Rendlesham Forest area. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about
that
and also a little bit more about the history of sightings of the area. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, boy, you take that one, Pete, because Pete wouldn't talk to me for like a year after that.
That upset me very much. Dee, I hope you're doing well, and please send our best wishes to David as well. As you know, for me, the last thing I expected in going back to England and investigating this subject, especially so early on Larry's and my first of probably 15 trips each since that time, in February of 1988, we had, for anyone who hasn't read the book, an ongoing multiple UFO incident that involved several dozen different machines or appearances or whatever you want to call them that ran, well, they were still happening an hour and a half after we started watching them, but we had arrived in that part of England just the day. That day, we had arrived in England the day before. We were tired, and Larry suggested on that first night on location that we take a walk, go out to the base where we could go on to the civilian area. It was very compelling, very exciting for me, also kind of romantic in that, you know, it was nice that Larry reminded me it was a night very much like his original incident in 1980, which thrilled me no end. And on the way out there, he said something to the effect of, you're going to see it while we're here. We had planned to be there for a week, and we were. And I said, what do you mean, see what? And he said, UFOs, they're here, you're going to see them. And I thought he was just exaggerating. About half an hour later, the first one zoomed over. We made a nervous joke about it being a weather satellite, and in fact, it stopped, it pulsated, changed color, and it took off, and I cannot play that tape in Nick's company. After getting quite a walk around the base and Larry chatting up a security police officer who was essentially in his same position but years later and confirmed how seriously, without any prompting, this story was taken, we started to head back to the bed and breakfast we were staying at. It was very dark. There was no real ambient light to speak of. The base was receding in the back, and at about 9:30 exactly, I noticed a elliptical shape over the forest and pointed it out to Larry, gave him a recorder. We both had a microcassette recorder in our hands, and for the next hour and a half, we did our best to just report what we were seeing. The transcript of that incident is carefully reproduced in the book. And several years ago, I was contacted by two gentlemen who did voice stress analysis, had never done it in connection with the UFO-related incident, but I loaned them our first-generation audio tapes and they came up smelling like roses. The stress in our voices apparently is measurable and is real. And you could have been trained as an actor by Lee Strasberg himself, and you couldn't make that happen with voice stress analysis.
I think we ate packs of cigarettes, if I recall.
Yeah, it was a big night for the tobacco industry, no question.
Yeah. Between us.
I'll wait through this, baby.
That thing happened, and that, you know, when after that, I think Peter and I began our kind of, we didn't know where the book was going to go, so long ago now, but...
I was so shocked. I had no...
It really was a bad thing, because... You know, I mean, the poor guy has come into this. I knew we were going to see UFOs. I mean, they were. It was the craziest damn thing. And just off the south end of the Bentwaters flight line in the forest, it just shouldn't have happened, but it did. And I wish we had had a video camera, I guess, but then people, who would believe that either, right?
Yeah.
But it happened. And the problem we had, remember, we kind of fell out over this.
I was on overload at that point. I really thought this was going to be a little more academic and that I'd be doing some nice research and looking at articles and not having disc-shaped things flying over my head in a very scary little corner of England. I mean, I'm half joking here, but I've had people say to me, ND again directing this question to you, what an amazing break for an investigative researcher in our field. I mean, you're with a key witness to a seminal UFO incident. You go back to the location, your very first night on your very first trip, and now I couldn't tell you how many times I've been back to that area. You've got this amazing multiple UFO incident. Well, think again. Larry was, at the time, hardly uncontroversial. And the fact is that this was the first night of my first visit. And Larry cut me a lot of latitude on this. He made it clear that if I decided, you know, not to include it, that would be all right with him. One thing we were really sure about was you couldn't just make a passing reference to it. Oh, yeah, by the way, on our very first night back on location, we saw 30 UFOs. And, boy, breakfast was sure good the next morning. You can't do that. And so I spent almost a year listening to those tapes. Every syllable, every partial syllable, because I knew we were going to get hit. But it was wild. It went from things as small as stars zipping around in the sky to things that were decidedly elliptical, dropping down in the woods, lighting up the woods, no sound on anything. And then ultimately a thing with what looked like three discernible windows set in a metallic curved structure that appeared in the field we were in. X number of yards ahead of us, which was terribly upsetting to me, and at that point Larry just started walking toward it, saying words to the effect of, why don't you leave me alone? Why? What are you doing? Why are you always getting... And I can't say half of the things he said, and at that point I literally put my hand on his shoulders, he was walking toward it, cursing it, and said something like, think about what you're doing, thinking to myself that I don't know at that point whether I was more concerned about being picked up by Air Force security, being so close to a secured NATO base, maybe watching some kind of classified thing going on, or ending up on Mars for dinner. So I was freaking, no question about it, and we did back away at that point and just continued to watch it, and it went on and on. And again, anybody that wants to get a piece of it, it runs about 19 pages or so in the revised edition of the book.
You know, people must really just, you know, think, what were these guys smoking back then? I mean, or any throughout the thing.
Marlboros.
We laugh a lot. There's a lot of humor. We're both from New York, and it's kind of a coping mechanism. Even 9/11, I think this kind of this weird gallows humor. And I'll tell you that as real as that was, and as bizarre as that was, it was the last thing we needed. But I look back now, I literally was just on the floor on my knees when he said the trip to Mars, because he said it that night when it was happening. He goes, you know, literally, I remember you grabbed me saying, like this, I don't really feel like a trip to Mars tonight. Because, I mean,
it's not nervous humor, but yes,
whatever it was,
this
stuff
way.
Was right there around us, and it was right near this place where all this had happened. And what it said to me is there a possibility that these things do have some kind of a base there, for God's sake? You know, you wonder, you know, what's the truth? Where does it end? What did the spooks say that was true? What did they say that wasn't? What was meddled with? What wasn't? Maybe we weren't meddled with at all. God knows. If it's the latter, then we're really in.
And I should also reiterate that this experience that we're talking about, which happened, February 18th, 1988, I'm sure, I'm just guessing here, was only 5.5 or 6 miles from the site of Larry's third night incident. So we're still right in the Bermuda Triangle here. It's not like it's on the other side of the country or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That happened, though, so it's as humorous and bizarre and just still kind of, I still think of that and you try to put it in perspective, but that was too much perspective.
Yeah, right. But thank you for your question, D.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you what, well, we've got about 10 minutes to the break. Let's see, we can get one more question before the break. See, TRMT 137 has been patiently waiting with her hand up. Oh, I don't know if we should have made this one wait, y'all. TRMT, why don't you come up and give us your first name and location, and you're live on there with Peter and with Peter and Larry.
Fascinating accounts and programs, gentlemen. Therese from Massachusetts. Sirs, your website notes that the U.S. base commander verified certain aspects of these sightings. Regarding these events, do you know of particular staff debriefings or later information indicating that senior base personnel anticipated these alien craft sightings? Also, this evening's comments have noted strategic concerns. From these debriefings or later research, was there any indication of a link between certain alien groups and a particular NATO alliance focus, such as military or civil security, scientific or environmental areas? Thank you for your responses, gentlemen.
Thank you. There were indeed briefings after those events. Thanks for the call. And with senior people, I wasn't privy to any of the senior level briefings. We were debriefed according to rank. And it was very informal, well, not informal, but it wasn't a structured kind of thing. It was thrown together quite quick because they had to contain this thing. As far as, I think you might be referring, was there a, and that can be researched by just about anyone. There's plenty of these senior folks involved that now can hopefully one day their pensions won't get in the way and they can speak freely about that level of the game. As far as,